This is 8:30 a.m. on August 18th, 2021, and I call the meeting of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners Complaint Screening Committee to order. Ms. Michelson, will you please call the roll?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Catarino?
Present.
Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Gill?
Present.
We have quorum.
Thank you. So moving on to the approval of minutes, since Dr. Gill is recused from this item, I make a motion to approve the regular session and executive session minutes for the July 21st meeting. Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you, Dr. Catarino. So we have a motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. None opposed, and Dr. Gill is recused, so the motion passes. So moving on to agenda item number four, case discussion and decision. I wanted to mention for those in attendance some important preliminaries. The Complaint Screening Committee, according to Arizona Revised Statute Section 32-2081, subsection H, may dismiss the complaints appearing on this agenda or refer them to the full board for consideration and action. Complaints dismissed by the committee shall not be disclosed in response to a telephone inquiry or placed on the board's website according to ARS Section 32-2081, subsection H1. Upon a vote of a majority of the quorum, the committee may go into executive session on any item on the agenda according to ARS Section 38-431.03, subsection A2, to review confidential records, or according to subsection A3 to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney. For those in attendance, please keep in mind that the chair, which is me, reserves the right to change the order of the items on the agenda based on parties present and requests to speak. A person or a representative of a person who has filed or received a complaint and is present at today's meeting may make a brief statement of up to 5 minutes to the committee when prompted by me. The committee may also have questions for those who speak. Please only use initials for patients, children, and the complainant. Keep in mind that the content of many records involved in these complaints is confidential and the content should not be discussed in a public meeting. Keep in mind that the committee will go into executive session to discuss any confidential records. So with those preliminaries in mind, the first complaint to be discussed today is number 21-20 for Kim Kalis. So this case was reviewed by the committee initially at its meeting on July 21st. The committee discussed that it would be helpful to review the trainings that Dr. Kalis has taken related to her family court work and to hear from the other treatment professionals involved in this family court case, specifically the complainant's therapist, Dr. David Dubner, her daughter's therapist, Ms. Catherine Meyer, and the son's therapist, Ms. Ashley Armand, if I'm pronouncing all of those names right. The committee voted to table the matter for review at a future date and directed the board staff to contact the treatment professionals in this case to coordinate their participation and testimony at a future meeting, which is today's meeting. These three professionals have confirmed my understanding that they are present for today's meeting, and board staff, Ms. Michelson, can we confirm that they're present?
See, I do see that we have Dr. Dubner here, and I believe that Ms. Meyer and Ms. Armand, they did call in, and they're from the same office. Ms. Meyer, can you please confirm that you've called in?
This is Catherine Meyer.
This is Ashley Armand.
Excellent. Thank you. I do see that we have Dr. Kalis here, the complainant. I do not know if she is here on the line. KB, are you here today? I did send her the link for the meeting, Mr. Chairman, as well as this morning. I followed up with her. I've not heard back, so it would be at your discretion whether to proceed in her absence. But we do have everyone else here.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson, and thank you, everyone, for being here. So I think we can proceed. Dr. Catarino, since you are the lead committee member for this complaint, could you please provide a summary or a brief overview and any updates with respect to the additional information that has been provided by the complainant and the licensee since the last CSC meeting.
Okay, thank you. So I just wanted to give a brief update. So at the last meeting, we had a few questions, and one of these was, did Dr. Callis have specific training in forensics, custody evaluations, reconciliation? And second point, did she send copies of her continuation records to us? So yes, and the answer to that is yes, we did receive them, and it's up to, I guess, the committee to determine if they are appropriate, but I did see many related to forensics and custody issues. Okay, any comments, Dr. Diner or Dr. Gill?
Thank you, Dr. Catrino.
Then I'll go to the next point.
You and I were in the previous meeting and Dr. Gill wasn't, so it might be helpful to provide a brief overview of what the factual scenario is.
I was just preparing the update. So this I don't have notes on, but last time we had a concern from patient's mother. There was a court order for Dr. Callis to work with his family, and it was a mother, a father, they were unmarried, and they had two children together. So they separated, and then there was a concern about custody and about the mother and son reconciling. There was some conflict, and the father and daughter having reconciliation therapy, and even the brother and sister having reconciliation therapy. Okay. So at that point, mother, at the end of this, Dr. Callis felt that father and daughter had reconciled, though mother was concerned that there had been many points in the therapy where Dr. Callis ignored her daughter's concerns about meeting with the father and her anxiety about having these joint sessions. Mother had originally engaged Dr. Callis for individual therapy for the daughter, but then that was switched to the reconciliation and to a therapist, Catherine Meyer and Ashley Armand were selected as therapists for daughter and son respectively. And mother had her own therapist, Dr. Dubner. Okay. That's why we asked for them to be here. So the reconciliation therapy between mother and son was paused for 18 months. And mother was concerned that she lost this time with her son and that nothing was being done to help the two of them get closer. Dr. Callis's response was that mother had several issues that needed to be worked out prior to resuming reconciliation therapy. And we asked her mother's psychologist to be present to see if he saw the same issues and thought also that she was not ready to resume reconciliation therapy. There were other concerns. It was a very lengthy case. There were other concerns about whether or not the updates mother had received coincided with the report she had from the daughter about what actually went on in the therapy sessions. There was a concern that Dr. Callis did not send notes, her notes to anyone, either the court or the parent. There was a concern about financial records, but at the end of that session, it seems to be that that was resolved. So let me get to the updates that we had. So there was a question about, did Dr. Callis have appropriate training in this area? And many certificates of continuing ed were received. There was a question as to whether or not Dr. Callis needed to get informed consent from both parents. And I know sometimes in married situations that is the case, but we had Jean Galvin research this, and she said it was not required to have parental consent from both parents. There was the question about the notes matching the daughter's recollection, and we And I questioned how this was the case because no one had received the notes. But then it was made clear to me that the mother had sent, had received updates from Dr. Callis in emails as to what had gone on in the sessions. And she was comparing the updates to the daughter's comments. But I don't think at this point that any notes have, I never saw any notes in the file, and in no report that the notes had been received by anyone. And then, of course, we have the question about the reconciliation therapy being paused. Dr. Callis responded that she had spoken to Dr. Lavitt, who was court ordered to oversee this case, and also to Dr. Jean Mohn, a colleague and from NAU, and also a member, had been a member of the board. And they sent letters that they, she had conferred with them, and they agreed. The way I read it, they agreed with her pausing therapy. So I tried to, so now we're up to date. So I tried to look over the statutes that might be involved. There were many concerns, but what statutes were really violated? Well, I found three that might have been violated. One was the psychologist's activities congruent with the psychologist's education and training experience, and Dr. Callis did send in verification to support that. Another point, S, is failing to make client or patient records in the psychology's possession promptly available to another psychologist and also to records to available to the parents. So I don't know if there was ever a formal request in writing for the records. I wanted to find that out today. And I don't know if the psychologist, Dr. Callis, was ever asked to send records to the other therapists involved. So, you know, I have to, we don't know if she violated that one. If they weren't violated, I would like to know why. It, so that it might have been that the psychologist felt that they might be damaging to the case. And the last point that might have been violated, that at least we like to look at, is point E, gross negligence in the practice of psychology. And I wanted to see if there are differences in the way Dr. Callis thought to proceed, particularly the pausing and including the daughter in sessions that mother felt were very stressful for her, if they would be evidence of gross negligence or not. So that's where I'm at now. If you would like to add anything else, Dr. Mr. Diner.
Thank you, Dr. Catrino. That, I think, brings all of us up to speed. Thank you for your very well-worded summary. So I think the next step would be, since we do not have the complainant KV present today, I think the next step would be to hear from Dr. Callis. Dr. Callis, please correct me if I'm saying that wrong. So please state your full name for the record, and this will be your opportunity to make a brief statement if you wish for up to 5 minutes, and the committee members may have questions for you during this time. You may proceed.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. My name is Kim Callis, and I would like to comment on several points that were brought up in the last meeting by either the complainant and or the committee, just to clarify. Dr. Catarino already clarified the trainings that that I've attended in this area. In addition, I also provided some letters from the Coconino County Conciliation Court Coordinator in reference to my contract work with the court up here. And also I included two letters from some family, two prominent family law attorneys attesting to my competence in this area. So I believe that all that documentation attests to my working within the scope of competence on this case. I believe that Ms. Galvin already addressed the informed consent issue, but just to clarify, there were four sessions which I did not have father's written permission, as I trusted mother's account of having sole decision-making power. That was a mistake on my part. And the first time I spoke to the father, I realized that father had a joint decision-making power, and I obtained it informed consent from him immediately. So there were four sessions where I did not have that written consent. Fortunately, I rectified that quite quickly. In regards to the billing I provided to the committee, I know that the some documentation, because I know that the complainant stated both verbally and in writing that I, quote, simply or insisted that she pay what I said she owes me without explanation. I provided the committee with emails that on at least four different occasions I offered to meet with the mother or speak to her on the phone and go over my bills step by step. And the mother continued to want to debate this and challenge the billing over email, which proved to be very time consuming. And ultimately I said, if we continue this by email, I'm gonna have to charge you for your time. And I thought talking was more appropriate. So I do think that we were able to ultimately resolve that. I also want to address the release of records. It was incorrectly stated at the last meeting that I was issued a court order for my records. By the way, I was never, no other psychologist has asked for my records, but I was not issued a court order. A court order is signed by a judge, and I would have had to comply with that for sure. What I was given was a subpoena by an attorney. And please keep in mind that these records were not just the children's records. They also involved and belonged to both parents in the case. And since both parents have equal decision-making power and the father opposed the release of the records, I could not just release those. And so I asked the court to make a decision about releasing those records. And yes, I felt like if I released the records during reunification counseling, it would have been incredibly detrimental to that process because I did not feel that all the parties were on board with the reunification. I also had talked to the kids. The parents had assured me early on in the case that confidentiality would have been protected. So that's what I assured the children in this case. And I didn't think it was fair to then go back and release the records. As far as updates to the mother, after every session that I had with daughter and father, I emailed the mother update on the issues we discussed and how they were addressed. So I believe I did due diligence there. Also in the last meeting, Dr. Catarino asked how I addressed mother's allegations of biasness, and I explained that father was more responsive to my input and my suggestions, but I also neglected to emphasize that I did consult on numerous occasions in this case. I consulted frequently with Catherine Meyer. I consulted frequently with Dr. Ron Lavitt. I consulted with Ashley Armand. And I also consulted, as Dr. Catarino mentioned, with a trusted colleague of mine, Dr. Jean Moan, who is a neutral professional in this case. I had hoped to collaborate with David Dubner on the case because I felt like that collaboration was absolutely vital to the reunification, the success of the reunification between mother and son. But for whatever reason, he either was not seeing what I was seeing or not able to collaborate with me. And as I mentioned in my initial response to the committee, there are two professionals in Flagstaff that are conducting reunification counseling. One is me and one is Catherine Meyer. So in regards to just using a family therapist to conduct reunification counseling, given the legal involvement and contentiousness of this case, a family therapist without family law experience would not have been sufficient in this case. And so as far as the pause of reunification, I wish to clarify to you that I fully anticipated this pause to be temporary, to be a month to 2 months at most. There were some issues that mom was dealing with that was hindering the reunification process, and I wanted her to address those in her own therapy because she was not able to address those within the confines of reunification counseling. And mother refused to find a therapist that was willing to work with her on these issues for 18 months. There really was nothing more I could do with that, because in the interim, in my constant contact with the son was refusing to come back into reunification counseling, and he was refusing to switch counselors to deal with the reunification. And the reason being, he said, Kim, as soon as my mom hears something she doesn't like, she'll just fire that person too. And he was not willing until he knew that mom had a chance to work on some of the things that were hindering the reunification process. I believe that is about it. There were several statements made by the complainant in the last meeting that were false, other than those that I've pointed out just in the last few minutes. But I, you know, everything from dad wasn't involved in the kid's life early on to me suggesting that Elle block her mother's contact from the phone. But I'm not going to take the board's or the committee's time with that minutia unless there are specific concerns there and you have questions for me about that. I'm happy to answer anything. So I'm prepared to answer questions from the committee at this point if there's anything that I haven't adequately covered.
I did want to ask this. Is mother present? Did she come in yet?
AB, are you present? Dr. Katarina, I do not believe she was here. She was noticed of today's meeting, which contained the participation instructions, as was Dr. Kellis. The complainant did reach out to me yesterday asking for the Zoom link, which I provided to her. And I also emailed her this morning to ask if she was participating, and I have not heard back, so I do not know what her reason is for not being here today.
Okay. Well, Dr. Kellis, the only question I have at this point is the 18 months. I remember reading that mother had an intern that then as her therapist, and then the intern graduated or moved on. And then I didn't recall that it was 18 months till she that she had no psychologist working with her. I thought that was the total amount of time of pause, not that the total amount of time that she had no therapist or psychologist.
I believe she had a therapist earlier than that, but she wasn't willing to work on the issues that I saw that were hindering the reunification. I know that Dr. Dubner had told me in an email that he was not seeing the same concerns that I was seeing, and I wish we could have collaborated about that because I think collaboration in this case was of the utmost importance. For example, just case in point, Catherine Meyer was reporting some anxiety on the part of the daughter for the reunification sessions. I did not see those. And so we reached out to each other, collaborated about what do you think's going on? Why do you think she's reporting anxiety and I'm not seeing it? What do you think we can do to, or I can do to make this easier on the daughter? And the end result was that reunification was successfully completed. And I wish the other reunification had been as well.
So how often did you reach out to Dr. Dubner? I saw one email.
Yes. There was one. I had periodically emailed mom. And there was one appointment that I had with mother and her attorney to discuss in depth what the concerns were. I wasn't willing to put those concerns in a report for everybody to see because I was trying to protect mother's confidentiality and integrity. So in turn, mom thinks that I was being vague, and that wasn't my intent at all. My intent was not to air her dirty laundry in front of everyone. And so I reached out to mom. I'm sorry, let me back up. The mother's attorney canceled the appointment with me. That would be Deshaun Pullen, because mom didn't want to pay for Deshaun's time in that meeting. And also at the time I was scheduled for a deposition in this case, and mom did not want to pay for both meetings. So the attorney canceled the meeting. I emailed mother and I said, again, I'm so sorry that, you know, we can't seem to connect. So you can be working on these things. And at that point, then she emailed me and says, oh, please feel free to reach out to my psychologist. So I did. And Dr. Dubner and I spoke, I want to say it was September 21st, which was a long time after February. For about an hour, and I articulated what my concerns were, some of the behaviors I was seeing, what I felt needed to be changed. And also I included in that phone conversation strengths that I thought that KV had as a parent. So in 4 months after that, I contacted Dr. Dubner to find out how the work was going. And he responded that he wasn't seeing those issues, and he did not recommend that his client continue reunification counseling under my supervision.
So you talked to him, contacted him twice in September and 4 months later?
And then in January, yes.
And how did you reach out? How often did you speak to the daughter's therapist and the son's therapist?
Son's therapist was probably, I want to say, over the course of treatment about four times. And it was maybe 3 to 4 times. It was more limited because reunification was on pause, and there was not much to collaborate with after the pause happened. The daughter's therapist, I would have to go back, but I would say at least 10 times over the course of treatment, everything from what I could do in my sessions to make the daughter more comfortable. What are some of the issues that she and I felt needed to be worked on, and why there was a discrepancy between the mother and daughter reporting high anxiety in these sessions and the father and I and the brother not seeing that level of anxiety at all.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kalis, and thank you, Dr. Catrino. I might have a few questions to ask, but I would like to hear from the other therapists who are attending, other treatment professionals who are attending the meeting. So Dr. Gill, do you have any questions?
Yes, I do. I want to ask Dr. Kalis, your response to a post that the mother had contributed to that was critical of you. I was a little concerned about your response to it. You included her initials in your response, and I have to ask you how appropriate that was to include her initials. First of all, it was likely that she might have posted this, but you didn't know that for sure. And the appropriateness of using her initials in a response just seems unprofessional. Do you comment on that?
I do have a comment on that. I've had people post negative reports online over the years because of the nature of the work I do. And I didn't know for sure who it was. I guess that it was somebody that was in a court-appointed case, because otherwise, if somebody were seeing me and felt this way, they would just terminate counseling, right? So I had no idea for sure who it was. I used her initials for a couple of reasons. I used her initials because all of a sudden on this website, there were all these negative reviews, these one-star reviews. And I couldn't figure out how to stop them. And so my hope was if I used her initials, first of all, I knew no one would know that it was her with the exception of the possible author. And if the author knew that she had been found out, that my hope was that she would cease and desist with the negative reviews. I also, in the past, anytime there has been a negative online review, it doesn't go away. I'm basically stuck with it. And so my response was intended to educate the public and defend the professionalism of my practice and my integrity, because my heart really is about protecting children in these cases, because these cases are hardest on them for sure. After I posted that, I contacted the website and asked them, because there were several, like six people found her review helpful, which I found hard to believe because the review really didn't give much information at all. Anyway, they investigated and they found numerous postings, not postings, but ratings plus her post, suspicious, because they seemed to be coming from all the same place. So they took them down. And so my post was not up there very long, but I do understand your concern. I think in all honesty, I just was trying to defend myself and did not know that I had any other recourse to do it. Had I known that I could contact the website immediately and have them investigate and have it taken down, I would have done so.
Thank you. And I have another question. Dr. Catarino had brought up the issue of your bias against the mother. And maybe because of my own experience in writing a number of reports, it's important that the words that we use in these reports is critical to the points we want to make. And I'm just going to give one example. I think you used the term manipulative when referring to the mother. And I had a really strong reaction to that word, and maybe to some other comments that you made in the reports. I think it does support the argument that perhaps you had some bias by using what I would consider to be pejorative remarks with the individual that you're, with the mother and family that you're reporting on. And I just wanted to know what your comment is about that.
Okay. And sir, are you talking about the use of the word manipulative in an actual report that I sent to the parties? Okay.
Yes.
I can give you some examples of that, and you may disagree with my definition of manipulativeness.
Well, if you describe the process without using the word, that would have been fine. It's the word itself that, to me and my reading, has a pejorative meaning.
And I'm so sorry. I would love to speak to your concern, and I'm not sure in what context or what page you're seeing this at.
Yeah,
I understand what you're saying. There were several incidents where there was, I would say, manipulativeness in the case, both past and present, where if there was an argument between mother and father, mother would put dad on speakerphone so the kids could hear, and then mom would cower in the corner. And I really saw that as being manipulative.
Okay, I'll let it go with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. And I see the complainant, KB, has joined the meeting. So I want to circle back. And KB, thank you for being here. And you may wish to make a brief statement of up to 5 minutes at this point, or just to answer any questions that the committee members may have.
Yeah, I would. I'm sorry. I couldn't get on this morning. So pardon me. I do have a statement that I would like to read from, if that's okay.
Just keep it to 5 minutes if you can, please.
Okay. Hold on 1 second. Let me pull this up. Okay. So, in both the execution of reunification between father and daughter and the failure of unification between mother and son, Dr. Callis created harm. Number one, alignment with the father and interference with co-parenting. In her actions, email exchanges, and reports to the court, Dr. Callis's bias and alignment with father is on full display. It is my hope that the members of this committee might have had the time to carefully review the emails I submitted. From the beginning, Dr. Callis expressed alignment with father, first insisting upon our daughter's reunification with him, even when it was not her prescribed role and our daughter was not ready. Dr. Callis encouraged father to communicate his concerns to her and discouraged direct communication with me. She empowered herself and father by playing the middleman, repeatedly serving as the father's voice and carrying out his wishes without questioning his intent or verifying evidence he might provide. She went so far as to respond to communication I had written to father so that he would not have to. The following is an example. This email was written to father after he brought unsubstantiated concerns to Dr. Callis rather than communicating with me directly. So this was from April 30th, 2020. This is a message from me to the father. Good morning, father. I want to assure you directly that I fully support your reunification with L. If you had a problem with me dropping something off for L, or the two of us texting, you could have let me know directly, and I would have gladly done what you felt was best. In the future, I will talk to you if such needs arise. Moving forward, I hope you'll communicate with me when you have an issue or concern. I want to do whatever I can to help Elle feel comfortable in your relationship and for your reunification to be successful. In peace, Karen. Instead of father responding, Dr. Callis responded on his behalf, ensuring that father does not have to participate in the co-parenting relationship. Dr. Callis responds, hi, Karen. That was a very pleasant message you sent to Alex. I know you'd prefer to communicate directly with him, but as I said, we're just not there yet. Hopefully we will be someday soon. Sincerely, Kim. Dr. Callis's alignment with father and her efforts to control co-parenting on his behalf enabled father to alienate my son from me and act with impunity. Two, Dr. Callis was complicit in father's parental alienation and failed to perform reunification between me and my son. Dr. Callis makes her own rules, ones that enabled father's parental alienation. She has made wildly contrived interpretations of the parenting agreement in father's favor, at times completely ad-libbing and making sweeping harmful decisions that compromise my daughter's safety and well-being. During the four reunification meetings with my son, Dr. Callis consistently and overtly disrespected me in front of him, condoning and encouraging his disrespect and alienation. He quickly learned that any reluctance he expressed with reunification whatsoever would be rewarded with independent decision-making. When stories of discomfort arose, Dr. Callis made no attempt to verify what actually transpired or work through the issues via reunification, but instead would reprimand me or cancel my outings with my son and then reunification altogether. At no time during our reunification did I ever feel Dr. Callis was an advocate for our relationship. And on February 3rd, 2020, in an email, Dr. Callis stopped reunification without just or even identifiable cause. Dr. Callis never told me directly what concerns she had. It wasn't until 6 months later in her report to the court that she outlined her concerns, which were vague and without any supporting evidence. In the last hearing, Dr. Callis made the false statement that there was no temporal relationship between my critical online review of her and her decision to stop reunification. I've provided the board with the emails that clarify the timing of Dr. Callis's decision. My review was posted on February 2nd, 2020. Dr. Callis stopped reunification the very next day on February 3rd. The online review was intended to be anonymous, yet Dr. Callis was able to discover my identity and respond to my review using my initials and implying that I was abusive and manipulative. Her response was not only unprofessional, but intimidating, unethical, and frankly, creepy. As a measure of comparison, the medical board under which I practice would almost certainly suspend or revoke my license to practice medicine. I have this verified if I had made such a public statement to a patient. It would be considered a blatant and deliberate breach of ethics. Curiously, those reviews and her response have disappeared from the site. Three, harm to daughter. There was a gross double standard between treatment and of my son and my daughter when it came to reunification under Dr. Callis. While she seemed interested only in my son's perspective and concerns during the reunification, she took the opposite approach to my daughter, disregarding every sign and symptoms of anxiety, trauma, and putting her in harm's way. In contrast to reunification between my son and me, which was halted without factual basis for any attempt to move forward, Dr. Callis plowed through reunification between father and daughter, despite objective evidence that she was experiencing intense anxiety and even trauma. Dr. Callis knew of three separate incidents of Elle running away from her father in a hysterical and traumatized state, and she was made aware that Elle's PTSD scores had doubled after the third incident of Elle running away, clarifying the existence of trauma. Yet she claims she could not identify any evidence of trauma and never considered pausing reunification. In addition, both Elle and I had expressed to Dr. Callis on numerous well-documented occasions that Elle's time with her father and the reunification meetings themselves were creating harm. Dr. Callis did nothing. She, in fact, exacerbated matters in coordination with the father by failing to inform Elle of reunification meetings until the night before or the day of. Dr. Callis impelled father to veto three different counselors put forth for Elle. This delayed Elle's access to her own therapist for 9 months, including the first 5 months of reunification. During that entire time, Elle suffered from anxiety and depression. During that time, Elle needed therapeutic intervention and support the most. Dr. Callis had prompted the father to deny it. In emails I provide as evidence, Dr. Callis interprets the parenting agreement in alignment with the father and denies me communication with my daughter when she is with her father, further exacerbating the anxiety and the trauma. She's also failed to produce records of her visits with both children, nor documentation of her direct communication with father and son. I think it would be helpful for the board to access such documentation and the complete file of my family's case. Thank you.
Thank you, Libby. Dr. Kalis, we'll come back to you, but let me see if any of the committee members have questions to ask KV at this time. Dr. Cadrino?
How long was it that you did not have any psychological services, not receive psychological services, from the point when Dr. Callis said you needed to go to therapy to work on your issues? How much time had elapsed before you resumed therapy?
There was never a lapse in my therapy.
When you were first seeing a student that graduated, there was no lapse between when she graduated and when you began
when
with Dr. Dubner?
There was not. In fact, there was I started the same week. So I finished, I had two appointments that same week, one with Megan Treza, she was an intern at Northland Family Health Center. I returned to seeing Dr. Dubner that same week. So there was no lapse.
So I believe if I heard this correctly, that Dr. Callis might have said that there had been 18 months during this time that you did not have any therapy. Is that correct statement in your mind? Dr. Callis, could I ask you to repeat what you said? I may have gotten that wrong.
No, the complainant made the assertion that it had been, that reunification had been paused for 18 months. I didn't say that she wasn't in counseling. I said she refused to find a counselor that would work with her on the issues.
Did you give a time frame on that, I thought?
No, my anticipation was it would be a month or two. As I said,
had she refused to find a counselor, according in your opinion? I thought you said...
To find a counselor to work on these issues?
Yes.
She still doesn't have one.
Okay. And
she has a counselor. She has a psychologist.
Just oh, my gosh. Clear.
Okay, so, KB, so there was never a break in counseling?
No, and there's never been a refusal to work on the issues just because my psychologist doesn't deem Dr. Callis's assessment to be accurate. That's his professional opinion. That doesn't mean that I have not been willing to work. I've even said in emails to her that I would, earlier when she stopped reunification, that, you know, I wanted to keep going. I didn't understand. She was having Dr. Callis, from my understanding, was playing phone tag and with Megan Treza and Megan Treza's supervisor at Northland Family Health Center. They were frustrated with Dr. Callis because they couldn't secure meetings from her or really gather any information about what she wanted. They couldn't gather specific information from her. And this was during COVID, and they kind of, I don't know what happened because I wasn't involved in that back and forth. Megan Treza left. She moved on. She was an intern. She moved on. And I returned to seeing Dr. Dubner, who I had seen initially a couple of years prior. So there's not been any break in my care during this time.
Thank you. Any other questions for KV? Yes, Dr. Gibb.
KV, just a quick question. At the time and following the decision to pause the reunification, what were the reasons that you were given as to why the pause continued beyond, say, a month or two? Because we were told that it's because you weren't in therapy and or you weren't in therapy where you were not addressing the issues. I'm just wondering what you were told as to why this pause continued.
I was never told anything at all. I was never written an email. I was never, even when she paused therapy, she didn't give any reason why. She canceled a meeting that we had by saying, and this is in the emails that I've given to you guys, she said something about, you know, since you think that I am serving as father's voice, I don't see any reason for us to meet. So she canceled a meeting between us because I had basically called attention to the fact in an email that she kept speaking for the father. And it was a concern of mine, but she canceled the meeting. It's in black and white in the emails that I provided to you. Then she canceled the meeting, that she canceled reunification altogether. She never gave any reason for canceling reunification at that time. She never stated what the problems were. She never discussed the problems, as far as I know, with my counselor, because they were having a hard time discerning what it was that she had a problem with. And it wasn't until a court document 6 months later, at the end of July of 2020, that she listed, I believe, four things that she thought were a concern. None of them were particularly substantial. They were things like mother needs to familiarize herself with the stages of adolescent development. Those things are not an issue. The kinds of things that she brought. And she also didn't, in that document to the court, she also did not give any supporting evidence of why those things were a concern. So in the 6 months between when she paused reunification and when she wrote that report to the court, we heard nothing from her about what she thought the issues were. We heard nothing. And my counselors did not hear anything. I did not hear anything at all directly.
I just wanted to follow up with what you just said. So there was no, to your knowledge, there was no consultation between Dr. Callis and your therapist following the decision to pause the reunification. Was there, can you answer that?
I know that there was some phone tag. I know that I think that there may have been, I don't know if there's any actual conversations other than leaving phone messages, but my counselor at the time, and I met with her and her supervisor, they didn't feel like they could understand what Dr. Callis's concerns were, either because they weren't explained or they didn't think they were valid, but they didn't have anything specific to go on.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Galen. Thank you, KV. So I think at this point, let's let's move on to the treatment professionals. And again, thank you all for being here. Dr. Catrino, since you had suggested in the previous meeting that having Dr. Dubner, Ms. Meyer, and Ms. Armand present at this meeting would be helpful, why don't you get us started with the questions, and then we'll see if Dr. Gill and I have it.
This is Catherine Meyer. I just want to make a note that Ashley Armand needed to step out for the restroom for a moment, and she'll be right back.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. So is it Dr. Dubner? Okay, is that pronounced Dubner or Dubner? Oh, I think your mic is off. Hello?
Dr. Dubner, you need to unmute yourself. It's towards the bottom left of the screen.
And Ms. Meyer has, I'm sorry, Ms. Armand has returned.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Yes, I had a couple of questions. The first question was, how many times did you actually speak with or have an email exchange with Dr. Callis during this 18, well, I don't know if it was 18 months that you were involved or during this period?
Okay, before I address that, may I just simply introduce myself?
Sure, sorry.
That's okay. I am Dr. Dubner, David Dubner. I earned my PhD at Northern Arizona University in 2017. I've been a licensed psychologist in Arizona since 2019. I currently have a private practice doing counseling psychology, and I've worked in behavioral health since 2012 in various capacities. Those are my credentials. And then I believe you wanted a, could you repeat your question?
I have actually like four questions. So the first one, I just wanted to verify how many times you met with or emailed or had contact with Dr. Callis concerning KV.
Okay, I have a timeline of that. I have documentation.
Good, okay.
So after hearing from KV that Dr. Callis was requesting a meeting, that was August 1st, I emailed KV and noted that I would be happy to on August 4th. I met with a telephone consult from Dr. Callis. My records show it was 35 minutes long. And after that, I received an email from Dr. Callis on January 25th, stating that she would like a summary of KV's progress on the issues. And I responded, that was the 25th of January. And on the 29th of January, I responded with a document. There was some issue with receiving emails from my encrypted email server from Dr. Callis. So I sent her a document by U.S. Postal Service in which I stated that rather than me characterizing what I stated, I'll just say that was the time I sent her a document. And then February 12th, I received an email from Dr. Callis in response to that. That's the sum total of our exchanges.
Thank you. So was it ever explained to you, Dr. Callis, what Mother needed to work on in order to for her to proceed with reunification therapy? Was it clear to you what issues she felt were obstacles to the reunification therapy with KV and son?
The answer is yes. That would have been during the telephone consult I had with Dr. Callis. The the 35-minute consult, and Dr. Callis provided her she characterized the issues. I do want to say that, you know, I did receive permission from KV prior to this meeting now that would allow me to discuss, if I needed to, some specifics. But obviously, this is confidential information that's protected from therapy sessions.
Is this something that we need to go into executive session
if he wants to
present the goals?
Yes, but let's see, Dr. Katrina, if you want to finish asking the remaining two questions you have, and then if we
they're all related to the goals. I mean, so and they're all related to the goals and the severity of them. So I don't know if I have anything that would be discussed openly. So,
all right, then I'll make a motion to go into executive session for obtaining confidential information from Dr. Dubner. Ms. Gavin, is that?
And for possible legal advice. And the individuals that would be brought into executive session are the committee members, Dr. Dubner and Dr. Callis.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Gavin. That's my motion. Do I have a second?
Yes, second.
Thank you, Dr. Katrina. We have a motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. None opposed. The motion passes. So Ms. Michelson or Ms. Pakkanen should...
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm just confirming I have everyone selected to send into executive session. So I'll know in one moment. Okay, you'll receive the notification now.
Just so we are sure, can we, Ms. Michelson, please do a quick roll call just to make sure all three of us are here. I think, Ms. Pakkanen, you're speaking, but you're on mute.
I beg your pardon, Mr. Chair. Ms. Michelson was coaching participants on how to leave the room. Okay, here they are.
So I do see Dr. Gill, Dr. Katerino, and Mr. Dinar.
All right. So we have everyone back in open session. Are there any additional questions for Dr. Dubner at this time? Hearing none, let's hear from Ms. Meyer and Ms. Armand. Dr. Katrino, do you have any questions to ask?
I'd like to ask questions to Ashley Armand.
Hello, I'm here.
Okay, I'm going to ask general ones, and then if they're specific, we might have to, confidential, we might have to go into executive session.
Okay.
Does Dr. Dubner have a question? Because I see a little hand.
I'm sorry, I don't have a question.
Oh, because there's a little hand. Okay, so Ms. Armand, so these are some of the questions I have. Did you ever have a confidential release of information form between you and Dr. Callis?
Yes, I did.
Okay, at what date? Do you remember the date that was signed?
I can't recall the date offhand.
And do you know who signed it, mother or father?
We obtained releases from both mother and father.
Okay, good. During when did you meet with Dr. Callis on either phones or email or in person to discuss the reunification with mother and son? And with son's progress in therapy?
I spoke with Dr. Callis primarily by phone a handful of times and a couple of times via email correspondence.
Do you happen to have dates on those?
Offhand, I do not.
Okay. Well, now this, did you express, this is general now, did you express any, did your, well, I think this is all confidential, hold on a second. Yeah, I think I need to go back into executive session for legal and confidential information.
Okay. All right, that sounds like a motion, and we would have Dr. Kalis join us and Ms. Armand. Dr. Catrino, do you also want Ms. Meyer to join us at this time?
No, I would like to do it separately, please.
Okay.
I'll step out of the room.
Thank you.
And all right, so I'll second that motion. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. None opposed. Motion passes.
Matching agreement. I wish to again point out to the committee that every time there was a conflict between what father thought of the parenting agreement, what mother thought, I would consult with Dr. Lavitt. I wasn't just going off willy-nilly and making my own interpretation. So I consulted every time, and I believe that you all have a letter from Dr. Lavitt attesting to those consultations. Regarding my contact with Megan Trezza early on, KV's first therapist, I did offer to come by to meet with her, to talk with her.
Catherine Armand and Catherine Meyer and Ashley Armand are in the meeting.
Thank you.
Okay. I did ask to meet with Ms. Trezza and her supervisor. They said they needed to consult with their legal team since this was a court-involved case. I was very clear. I am not seeking information on KB's treatment. I simply wanted to talk with Ms. Trezza about what I was seeing in the reunification process that was hindering it, so they could work with the mother and get this back on track. And ultimately, Ms. Trezza and her supervisor contacted me and said, we really don't do that here. We just work to support our clients, and we don't do anything in the work with the court. Or anything that might need to change. So basically my hands were tied there. So it wasn't until August of that year, what was it, 2020? Sorry, when I was able to make contact with David Dubner, which actually happened in September. So I just wanted to clarify that. Also, I want to clarify, I provided documentation to the committee that I consulted with Ron Lavitt on January 31st about pausing the reunification, again, meant to be temporary. I also provided the committee with an email dated February 1st, pausing reunification and explaining some of the reasons why I felt it needed to be paused. It was the next day that the negative post apparently showed up online. So it wasn't after the post that I paused therapy. The post happened the day after. I did not see that post for several months because I typically don't look myself up on Google every day. And what had happened was an ex-client or an old client came back into treatment and had Googled my name to find out what address I was at, and happened to mention, hey, by the way, there's this really negative post about you. And so that's how I found it. And it was months after the fact. And my response happened 10 to 11 months after the last therapeutic contact with the complainant, and was only up for a matter of weeks before it was taken down. I did use the complainant's initials in effort to get the complainant to stop doing negative posts online. And I figured with initials, nobody would figure out who that was except for the author. And if you know, I mean, we use initials in this meeting. So, you know, I understand what the concern is there. I didn't really realize I had any other recourse. And Dr. Gill, I just briefly went through my reports. And I also want to clarify, I did not send any reports to the court. I sent them to the parties. So if they ended up in the court, it was because one of the parties submitted those. But I truly cannot find where I called the mother manipulative or what the context was. And if you can find that for me, I would so appreciate it.
I can't find it right now, but I didn't notify the location, so I think it would take too much time to do that. So I'm going to decline that offer.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
May I?
All right. So at this point, do we have any questions for Dr. Kalis or the complainant, KV? Hearing none, let's move on to deliberations. Keep in mind that the committee deliberation process is a discussion between just the committee members. So the complainant or Dr. Kalis or any of the therapists we heard from may not offer any comments during the deliberation process. And I wish to thank everyone for being patient with us and for participating in today's discussion.
May I make a statement at some point?
Well, I think, KV, we have heard enough, but a brief one-minute statement, and I will hold you to it. Thank you.
Thanks. So if you'll please review my emails and the timing between when that negative review was posted and when Dr. Kalis informed me that she was pausing reunification. The dates are clear in the emails that I submitted. They are right there. Also, Dr. Kalis asserts that she didn't interpret the parenting agreement willy-nilly or make, you know, kind of large sweeping interpretations. An example of an interpretation that she made is very clearly stated in the parenting agreement that Liliana can contact me twice a day for, it doesn't specify a time. She was allowed to make 2 phone calls per day to me. I was allowed to contact her for 1 20-minute phone call. Dr. Kalis took the liberty of interpreting that and said, well, what we really intended by this was that first phone call of the day was supposed to be if there was an exceptional, and she went on about the intention of that when the parenting agreement is very black and white and very straightforward, that Liliana was allowed 2 phone calls a day to me. It didn't specify.
Thank you, KV. That will be all. So let's begin the deliberations. Dr. Katerino, since you're the lead, do you want to start with the deliberation?
Did you say that this would be an executive session? I was confused. No.
No, this is a deliberation like we normally have in a complaint screening committee.
Okay, so to me, it looked like the biggest issue, since nobody really requested the notes, the training was present, financial records were worked out, it would be, is there gross negligence in the practice of a psychologist? I think that's the only statute that applies. Okay, in my opinion.
Yes, Dr. Katerino, I was trying to go through all of our statutory definitions for unprofessional conduct, and from what we have heard today and from my review of the information that was provided to us, I think subsection G is not an issue because you know, this is not a let me actually pull it up. This is not there isn't a question about training and experience. Subsection S is not an issue in my mind because you know, that subsection deals with obtaining proper authorization, and we know that there was informed consent here, and so that's according to me not an issue. subsection E that Dr. Catrino, you mentioned initially in your summary, gross negligence in the practice of psychology. I don't think that's an issue because, you know, the way the statute is written, we need evidence of gross negligence, not just negligence. And finally, I think Dr. Gill had identified the online post. Potentially, that could be a subsection B issue, betraying professional confidences. But in my mind, that is not an issue. There was, you know, every person has a chance to defend themselves and their actions, especially on a social media website where the complainant calls out a licensed professional. We can't have a standard that requires the professional to be silent in those circumstances. And I don't think any personally identifying information was disclosed to the public in any response that Dr. Kalis may have posted on social media websites. So that's sort of my assessment of any potential violations there may be. Obviously, I want to hear Dr. Catrino, your assessment, and Dr. Gill, your assessment. But it seems to me that this case should be dismissed at this time.
Should be what?
Should be dismissed.
Okay. The only concern I had was with E, and I didn't know if the pausing, the reunification, which stopped relationship between the mother and son for 18 months was excessive, and that I don't know if there was enough follow-up between Dr. Kallis and Dr. Dubner to see if mother had made progress and that reunification could have been continued. Another concern I had was the daughter was very upset in the beginning before she reached that turning point, yet her reconciliation therapy was not stopped, but son's was. I did still have some concerns about is there negligence in the practice of psychology.
Thank you, Dr. Catrino. Dr. Gill, I want to hear from you, but just as a point of what Dr. Catrino said, I'm looking for gross negligence, not just negligence.
See, that's what's very hard for me. It's very subjective.
Go ahead and finish.
Dr. Gill, yes.
I don't see gross negligence. I agree with Mr. Dinar. I do think an argument could be made about unprofessional conduct, subletter O. Unprofessional conduct by current standards. And also, I think Dr. Kallis admitted to making mistakes regarding the informed consent issue. I don't think we can just on that point alone, I don't think we can dismiss this case because there were some violations with respect to the informed consent. To be honest, I'm in sympathy with Dr. Kallis because people like her are in impossible positions in these courts and deal with very, very difficult, challenging, clinical, overwhelming issues. And, things don't go smoothly, almost routinely. And I think that has to be acknowledged. And we don't give people a pass if they cross lines ethically or legally. But nevertheless, I think that has to be taken into account, that kind of perspective. So while I'm not going to agree with the dismissal, I think we have to at least consider whether in sending this to the board, whether we should have a letter of concern regarding the informed consent issue. And I think I would leave it at that.
Dr. Gill, when She did have informed, my understanding is that she had informed consent from mother. And according to Ms. Galvin, she only needed it from one parent in this case.
And that's if, Dr. Canarita, only if there is not an order, an agreement in place that dictates otherwise.
Right. And there was not.
Oh, okay. So that was not needed and I misunderstood. So I think the argument around the long pause, you could argue that maybe she could have handled it differently. But, you know, it's a judgment call. You know, would you call that gross negligence? I see it as a judgment call. And maybe I'll just leave it at that. And I think I would support Mr. Dinar's dismissal of this case, therefore.
All right. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I make a motion to dismiss this case.
And I second.
There's a motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed?
Nay.
Please say no. Dr. Catarino is opposed. The motion passes. Thank you, everyone. And I again want to thank the therapists who took time out of their day to be present for this discussion. Dr. Dubner, Ms. Meyer, and Ms. Armand, thank you for your help.
Mr. Chairman, did the committee want to take a brief comfort break before proceeding to the next case? I just wanted to check first.
Yes, let's do that. Let's come back in 5 minutes or at 25 a.m. 10:25. Let's see if we have everyone. I see Dr. Catarino. I see Dr. Gill. So let's get started with the second complaint to be discussed. It's number 21-23 for Thomas Bruner. Please correct me if I'm saying that wrong. Dr. Gill, since you're the lead committee member for this complaint, would you please provide the committee with an overview?
Thank you, Mr. Dinar. This case involves Thomas Bruner, PhD. He received his PhD from University of South Florida in 2004. His license is currently active. Reportedly, he has a... has a private practice in Tucson. He conducts assessments and provides psychological services for children and adults. For the overview, HD and VD, mother and father, are the complainants. HD is a military veteran. I might add that I'm a veteran as well, to add some perspective here. HD had requested from the VA to consider the financial benefits of the VA's Helpless Child Program for his son. And this request was denied a number of times. So in April of 2020, HD requested Dr. Bruner evaluate his son. We'll call him MD. Now he's in his 40s, to see if the son meets the program's criteria. The chief example to emphasize here is, did he experience significant disabilities prior to the age of 18? This Helpless Child Program through the VA provides financial compensation to a vet whose adult child has certain disabilities and who is incapable of, quote, self-sufficiency, unquote. In May of 2021, the complainants, both HD and VD, filed a complaint alleging that Dr. Bruner issued his report late and that he would not release the report unless HD and VD pay an additional $4,730.25. HD felt that Dr. Bruner should have advised them earlier regarding the costs involved, felt that Dr. B was late in producing the report. Yet the claim by Dr. Bruner is that there were extensions to the deadline and the report was submitted in time. After receiving by the screening committee notification of this complaint, the complainants emailed the board staff saying they wanted to withdraw the complaint. They received a report and are now satisfied. However, once a complaint is received, it cannot be withdrawn. Parents did not formalize, reportedly, the decision-making role for the son with the courts. So the release of information signed by the parents in April of 2020 were not honored by at least some of the son's providers. Parents worked out the differences with Dr. Bruner. The report was submitted and a claim was sent to the VA supporting the claim for this helpless child program. On April the 7th and April the 20th, an oral explanation by Dr. Bruner to the son regarding access to and providing confidential information in a report was given and documented. It's not known whether the son actually signed a release of information or not, but it was documented, and that documentation was signed. Was documented and signed by Dr. Bruner. A copy of Dr. Bruner's standard consent form was sent to the parents April the 22nd of 2021, but the parents did not sign the form. Dr. Bruner realized his error while preparing the file for the board. Once Dr. Bruner found the error, he updated office protocol to ensure that such errors would not be repeated. That concludes this report. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. So I see maybe one of the complainants is present. If so, would you please speak up and please state your initials only for the record. And this is your opportunity to make a brief statement of up to 5 minutes, and the committee members may have questions to ask you at this time. I thought I saw KD present. I don't know if HD is present as well.
Mr. Diner, I did not see either, and it doesn't sound like they called in either, so.
All right. So I guess then let's hear from Dr. Bruner. I know you're present. Thank you for being here. And I think you are present with your attorney, Mr. Farron Akins. Mr. Akins, welcome back. So at this point, Mr. Akins or Dr. Bruner, do you wish to make a statement of up to 5 minutes? You're free to do so, or you may wish to answer any questions that the committee members may have.
Let me just for the record state, I'm Farron Akins. I'm counsel for your licensee. Dr. Bruner can introduce himself, and I know that he does have some comments to make. Thank you.
Good morning. Could the committee please clarify if they can hear me okay?
Yes.
Thank you. I do wish to make some statements, so may I offer my statements?
Yes, please.
Okay, thank you. First, I want to thank the committee for giving me the opportunity to address the complaint filed against me. I want to start by reassuring you all on the committee that the report I did was representative of the forensic work that I do. I want to respond to the contents of the complaint. I do appreciate you allowing me to address this committee today, and I welcome questions at the end. Regarding where the complainant says the assessment was expensive, it was explained that this would be a difficult and time-consuming evaluation at the first meeting. One of the difficulties was getting all of the necessary records, and I essentially was starting from scratch. The records spanned 30 years and totaled more than 1,000 pages. I discussed this. Did someone hear some background feedback? Okay. I discussed this issue of how records significantly affect pricing with the parents right up front. That's revealed in my working notes. The overall estimate I gave these folks at the first meeting was a range that at the top end was $7,000. The final charge was approximately $7,500. And there were a number of professional activities that I capped. This was well within the fees that would be charged for other forensic evaluation cases of this particular type. I wish to point out that the complainant indicated my fee was $250 an hour. Actually, in reality, my fee was always $225 an hour. If there had been questions about fees, I would have been happy to answer them. When the father was notified of the final bill, he reported he was fine with the total amount and he paid the bill promptly. This is a discoverable fact as it is contained in an email he sent to our office. Regarding this statement, a year had passed and the report was late. Clearly, the parents were unhappy this took this long. I can certainly appreciate their concerns because it was about a year. However, that was due almost exclusively to the obstacles I encountered to get the records, which were amplified due to the pandemic. Also, it was several months before the evaluee completed the release of information forms I needed before tracking down records. There was a lot involved in getting the information and then integrating it. And I did explain to the parents right up front at that first meeting about how getting records could take a long time. There's nothing in my records, including any correspondence, indicating these folks were unhappy about how long it had taken. Likely because we did give regular updates on the progress or the lack of it. Toward the end of this case, the father did leave a voicemail on January 4th, 2021, where he says, I quote, "Thank you for all you are doing. And we have experienced the same kinds of challenges with getting records." Regarding the statement that the report was late and missed a deadline, there was never a deadline that was missed. When it came to the point of needing to get the report provided, we did still not have all the information. I simply suggested they reach out to their point of contact at the VA and ask for a brief extension of time, which they immediately did. And they reported almost immediately that this was easily done. I can provide the email where the father reports being fine with that issue. Then the report was submitted and the VA confirmed safe receipt, and there was no issue at all. Regarding the perception that the report was being held hostage, I am very sorry if the parents felt that way, but that was not the case. In fact, the way we handled the release was directly following a process we had gone over with these parents on numerous occasions. They agreed and understood the need to do a feedback. That agreement is contained in my notes. Part of that agreement was payment was to be made before a report could be released. The reality is the complainant told me he did not want to see the report, and I really truly do not know why. Meanwhile, I was hoping to review the report with the parents before submitting it to the VA. I have no idea how there's a perception I was holding the report back. Excuse me. I knew the parents had a lot riding on this report, and I wanted to thoughtfully review the report with them during a feedback meeting, as I knew it was very complex versus going over the findings in a quick phone call, which is apparently what the father wanted. Again, I want to thank the committee for allowing me to appear and answer questions, and by all means, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Akins, do you wish to add anything? Or before we do that, let's see if the committee members have any questions to ask Dr. Dubner.
No, but thank you for asking. I think Dr. Bruner has well stated our response to the complaint.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I said Dubner, didn't I? I apologize. So Dr. Gill, Dr. Catrino, do you have any questions to ask Dr. Bruner? Yes, Dr. Gill.
Yes. Dr. Bruner, do you acknowledge that in your release of information that you, or consent form that you had, or at least intended to have the parents sign, that they failed to sign that report? Is that accurate?
That is accurate. There were a number of issues that contributed to that event, and I'm happy to discuss those if you wish.
Well, if there's mitigating circumstances, sure, we're open to that.
There were. And let me start out by saying, although the written consent form had not been signed, even after we had emailed it to the parents, which is on record, my assistant also had mailed it to the clients, which is on record. We still obtained verbal consent, and the contents of the verbal consent are contained in my working note of 4-7. And I believe that the contents of that note show that I did at least meet the basic criteria of a consent process. So I want to just say that right off the bat, Dr. Gill. That is an excellent question, and I would have asked the same question if I was on the committee. Let me now address the factors that contributed, Dr. Gill. This was at the beginning of the pandemic. And secondly, my assistant had gone out on emergency medical leave. She had emergency gallbladder surgery and frankly almost died. She came back to work, and there's a doctor note I can forward to the committee where it shows they wanted her to do light work. So here's the context. The pandemic's going on. These folks understandably do not want to come into the office. We are working with them to get them the consent form in a way that's safe for them because they're elderly, Dr. Gill. So we're trying to do that. I do the basic consent content contents in that meeting. And they were struggling with technology as well, Dr. Gill, because they're a very advanced age. And so there was issues like them saying our printer's down. And there was, as the emails show, a lot of communication between our office and these folks about getting them to sign the consent form. But Dr. Gill, I do want to end this current statement by saying, again, I did go over the basic kind of, I believe I met the criteria for the basic elements with that note, Dr. Gill.
Okay. And regarding the release of information to access the son's medical records, did you have a signature from the son releasing that information?
I do have a consent from the son who I talked to by phone, and that working note is dated that was a little bit later in April, and I can flip to it, Dr. Gill and committee, 421, where it shows that I went over who the report would go to, the nature of the process, the fact that this was an evaluation. I also asked MD to use those initials that we are using, if he was okay with the parents being involved, if he was okay with the Veterans Administration receiving the report, if he understood that he was going to be undergoing an evaluation. And at that meeting, as we went over those things, he appeared to have clarity about all of those and consented to those things.
Yeah, that was my follow-up question. Do you feel that he was competent to sign that release and to understand all the implications involved in what he was doing? Do you feel that he was competent?
Excellent question. This treating psychiatrist who I'd communicated with had told me MD is actually a very intelligent person, very advanced intelligence. So even though he had some very significant psychological difficulties, yes, I believe that he was able to grasp the nature of this process.
Did the parents have a power of attorney, or maybe I should be mentioning this in the executive session, but were they authorized place their signature on the releases or on the release of this information for the report that you were putting together?
This is a complex question, Dr. Gill. Do you and the committee mind if I refer to my notes?
I certainly don't.
Thank you.
I do recall, Dr. Gill, that Dr. Renner asked if they had a power of attorney, and they said they hadn't gotten around to doing that.
Yeah, I just wondered, maybe they got around to it later.
Dr. Gill, they did not. I did ask them that question very early on, as shown by that note that I wrote up on 4-7, and I did ask them if they did obtain that, and they said they had not. I don't know why. That's a family decision. I know they were dealing with a very extremely difficult situation. I could tell by their voices. True. And the fact that this was a Vietnam veteran, Dr. Gill, I had to proceed very sensitively and carefully. Dr. Gill, were there other parts of that question I did not answer yet?
No, I think that I'm just concerned that confidential information was not shared without the appropriate parties, authorizing that release of information. That was my main concern.
Okay, and I believe that upon review of my working notes, that both the parents in themselves and then separately with MD, they both went through a consent process with me where they both clearly understood that not only the nature of the evaluation, but where the evaluation would go and who it would be shared with. And they both consented independently.
Thank you, Dr. Brenner. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Yes, Dr. Catrino.
Okay, so I did see that in September, the son signed the release form. And I also looked twice. I saw those informed consents were blank. And I wondered, and I also see that somebody completed an SIB. Was that the parents or the son?
The scales of independent behavior, I did that with the parents because they were obviously could have more objective judgment of their son's functioning.
So I wondered why, you received that information back from them on the SIB, you received the release of information from the son. Couldn't you have gotten the informed consent from the son when you got the release of information?
That's an excellent question. Thank you for asking that. And here was the situation. As I became more and more knowledgeable of the son's functioning, it's clear that the nature of his specific kinds of disabilities and psychological impairments and the exact nature of his condition, which we cannot talk about, would make it such that this is a fragile person. So what I decided was to focus on having him sign the forms that had to do with his understanding. I'd be requesting records from various practitioners. And he did sign those, Dr. Catrino. Did I say your last name correctly?
No, you did not. It's Catrino.
Catrino, excuse me. Dr. Catrino. Okay. Thank you, Dr. Catrino. So what I wish to clarify is it was a strategic decision to first focus on having what I consider to be the more vital consent signed, because as you all might understand, with 1,000 pages of records, if I can't get access to 1,000 pages of records, there's not going to be a report I can produce. And so I decided to focus on having the client sign those, knowing that I had gone through a verbal consent process with him where he did consent and I met the basic elements, at least in my view. I'm happy to learn more today, by the way. And I could have tried to have him sign that, but given the nature of his condition, which again, we can't talk about, but I will just say it can include very serious concerns about being monitored, being watched, things like that. I knew as a clinician, and I've worked with this condition for many years, inpatient and on outpatient units, I knew I had to be extremely careful with how I approached this case.
Okay, then, you know, you referred to APA 6.03 and indicating that records need to be sent in an emergency situation. But there's also ARS 32-2061, which indicates that it is a problem if the licensee doesn't make patient records available to the patient or his representative. And it doesn't refer to any kind of emergency situation at that point.
Dr. Catarino, I apologize, but I got a little lost in what you were saying.
I'm sorry. You pointed out that the records were not sent when the parents first requested because, you know, they hadn't paid, but also, and you pointed out that APA 6.03 said that it's okay not to send the records if there's not an emergency situation, in so many words. But I'm mentioning that there's Arizona regulations 32-2061, which makes it an offense if a failure to make the patient records promptly available to the patient as well as their representative. So it doesn't refer in that law to any kind of emergency situation as it does in the APA principles. Not send the records when they first request was the point.
Dr. Catarino,
I apologize. Before you answer that question, a point of clarification for Dr. Catarino. The
yes.
section she's referring to is subsection 16S, I believe. And if that is accurate, it says... failing to make client or patient records in the psychologist's possession promptly available to another psychologist.
That's a different one. The CC is to the patient or the representative.
Thank you for the clarification. Yeah, that was my confusion. Thank you. And for Mr. Akins, so the question is whether subsection CC covers the scenario here. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't believe it does, but I'll let Dr. Bruner speak for himself.
Dr. Catarino, I humbly apologize, but the way you started out, what you said something about records weren't released to someone. Dr. Catarino, just please, for clarity, could you break down your question into specific parts? Because there's a number of things you're saying, and I wish to start with the first assumption you're working on. Please start with your first assumption.
Okay. My understanding was that the parents' concern, they said that the records were being held hostage. And I know you addressed that. That indicated to me that they wanted to receive the report and they didn't get it when they wanted to. And I know you gave them the opportunity to look at it on the 10th of May. But their concern, way it looked to me, was that they made a complaint that they did not receive the records on May 18th. Is that true or not true?
Well, I don't know. I can't try and represent exactly what they were thinking or exactly what...
That's in their complaint.
What, if you're referring to the statement that they wanted to see the report, Dr. Catarino, they never asked for a copy of the report. That I want to clarify that right off the bat. There was never a verbal over the phone, through an email. There was not a request to receive the report. In fact, Dr. Catarino, one of the things that is very different from nearly any other evaluation I have ever done is Mr. HD, specifically said, I do not need to see the report. You can send it right to the VA, which you can understand, Dr. Catarino, I was very uncomfortable with. So to be honest, let me clarify for the committee, I wanted to send them the report. I really, really wanted to send them the report. In fact, that is present in numerous communications, which I can cite. And HD said, we don't need to see the report. You can send it to the VA. Because my plan was, as of course is common in evaluation work, when you're done, especially with a report that's 30 something pages long, it's professional to then do a feedback where you go over the report, because I wanted to answer all of their questions. I wanted to make sure they were comfortable with the report before I sent it to the VA. And so we were really trying to have that happen. And for some reason, they did not want that. And I wanted to respect HD because he was a military veteran. I have veterans in our family. And I wanted to respect the fact that I didn't want to force it upon them, Dr. Catarino. No, you know what? Regardless of what you want, we're sending the report, particularly because of HD's status with the military. And, you know, various issues are discussed in our response statement. So I was coming from a place of empathy and professionalism. I was never for one second not trying to send them the report.
So what I don't understand what they're meaning by held the report hostage. And that appeared to me that they were not getting a report that they for that they wanted. But
okay. Well, Dr. Catarino, I do not wish to speak for them, and I don't know if my attorney has anything to say, but Dr. Catarino, have I answered your question fully? I'm happy to answer any other questions.
I just think I would, if the parents had been here, would have liked to understand what they meant by that, but I guess they're not here. I wondered if their phone call, when they said, just tell me yes or no, does he qualify, if that constitute a request for records?
I reviewed all of those things because that's an excellent question. They never made a request for the report. The father on May 10th, I was returning from vacation and I left a voicemail saying, I wish to have a feedback meeting so that we can go over the report and we can answer all your questions. We want to send you the report. We said that on numerous other occasions from May 10th forward, and that is all discoverable fact.
Okay.
The father wanted me to give a yay or nay, did his son meet criteria? And Dr. Catarino, with a report that's 30 pages, spanning over 30 years, 1,000 pages of records. This is a military vet. They've already been turned down at least twice. They came to me and said, we are at wit's end. We really want someone to do a very thorough evaluation. That is what they told me. They wanted a very thorough evaluation. And I wanted to, in the spirit of respect for that request, go over the report to make sure before it went to an external entity that they had any questions answered, et cetera. I did not wish to do a casual call and simply answer one question, knowing, as maybe some of you on the committee have experienced, when someone wants to know one thing, it opens up the Pandora's box of, well, we need to talk about these other things and these other things, because as you know, science is a web of science. It's a web of information. And so we were simply wishing to set up a feedback meeting. And we did not say like, oh, and the feedback would have to wait for a month or a week. We were ready to do a feedback immediately. But the father seemed to, on that day, expect I should get right on the phone with him, and I was not able to. Upon reflection, do I regret that? Do I think, well, even though I was inundated, could I have got on the phone? Absolutely. We can all play Monday morning quarterback. We can all, we can all look back and say, wish I didn't do that. But do I stand by the professional idea that it should be a professional call where they've reviewed it, or at least we've set up a time that's beyond a phone call? Absolutely.
Okay. Next question I have is, at what date, roughly, you don't need the exact date, did you have all the records you used, you referred to in the report?
Give me a moment, please. That's going to take a moment. Thank you. it looks like approximately February 16th, 2021, I had finally received the records from a psychiatrist where we had been, we had never spent as much time as we did on this case reaching out to practitioners to try and get all the records. There's a consistent correspondence, which are in the records we submitted, reaching out to the parents to update them on our challenges, reaching out to practitioners, calling practitioners. In fact, may I reveal this fact, which may help you understand the feeling in the room. There was a point when the psychiatrist's office said, okay, we know you really want the records. Please just don't contact us again. We will get back to you. And it wasn't that they were angry. It was that they understood we really needed the records and they had to go into apparently some storage and go back through records that were deeply buried. And so I want to clarify that we were really working very hard, and my assistants can all speak to this, very hard to get those records.
I certainly understand that. That's why I asked when you had them all. So is 3 months a typical turnaround to write a report after having all the records for you?
Well, after I had those records, I did additional work, but no, that I would not say that's a typical turnaround. I would not. I would say there were factors impacting that. I had to, after finally getting the records, go back over them and spend quite a bit of time integrating them. Again, it's 30 years of records. It's 1,000 pages. So I would not say 3 months is typical. But I would not say, I would say it can take significant time, especially with this kind of case, that many records, the need to integrate, the need to possibly do some more interviews. I did conduct some interviews after that, as my notes suggest. So it's not as if I stopped gathering information. When you say records, Dr. Catarino, what I'm hearing is paper records, but there were other professional activities like interviewing other parties, because as you can understand, finally getting all of those inspires the social scientist clinician to then think about, well, who do I need to interview now that I'm really able to finally look at all of these records? So it's not as if I just started writing the report the day after.
Okay. And I have just two more quick questions. One, I find the date when they requested the extension, okay, I never saw the date that they then set as the next due date.
That's because they were unable to give me a due date. In fact, the email shows, if we can go to the emails if you wish.
No, that's okay.
The emails,
so you never had the date.
I asked them, Dr. Catarino, I said, what is the updated date? And that's in an email. And they said, it was something like, well, we don't have an updated date, because of course you can understand I was feeling very, very serious about this. Like, look, I know this has taken this long. I want to know when is the next date, et cetera. No deadline was ever missed. It was submitted to the VA without incident. And that those are, some input.
Okay. And then in looking at your billing, so last question, I had never seen a proofreading charge before. Is that typical? I had never heard that.
It is typical, actually, especially for a forensic report that could be reviewed by judges, attorneys, other professionals, the lay public, not in this case with lay public, but members of the VA. It is very common. In fact, of the psychologists I'm aware of who do this work, I'm aware that it's very common. In fact, the editor who proofreads does this work for many psychologists throughout Arizona.
And they express the charge, they send the charge to the client, not to the psychologist. You expected the clients to pay that charge is what I'm saying.
Yes, it's a professional activity that's involved with an evaluation report. And it's a significant activity, especially when it's the gravity of this, the importance of it being able to be highly readable. For example, people at the VA who are going to be critically reviewing this, we know it was already rejected twice. So yes, I consider it professional and in fact necessary to not ask an office assistant who has no credentials as a proofreader to say, hey, would you please proofread this 30-page report before it goes to an external agency, which could affect the rest of a person's life.
Okay, thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you, Dr. Catrino. Any other questions for Dr. Buna? All right, I have a question actually for Mr. Akins, or maybe a series of questions. Please bear with me.
Yes, sir.
So the way I'm seeing this, seeing the facts that are presented in the materials and in today's discussion, it seems to me that the APA Ethics Rule 6.03 is one of the issues. My view is that there was no violation of 6.03 because it's not relating to emergency services. The second issue that was brought up is either subsection S or subsection CC of unprofessional conduct. Subsection S, in my view, doesn't apply because this wasn't this was not information that was supposed to be given to another psychologist. And as far as the consent of the parent is concerned, that relates to only a minor child, and there wasn't a minor child here. And as far as CC is concerned, I did not see anything where MD designated his parents as a designated representative. So could you please state your position, Mr. Atkins, on those three points?
Well, I appreciate your asking for a legal opinion on that, but that's not actually what my role is here today. I'm here as an advocate and a support for my client. And I would suggest—
Yes, I asked you a position. I did not ask you your legal opinion. I can form my own judgment on that. Thank you.
My apologies. I don't believe that it was necessary here because I think that Dr. Bruner did go through verbally providing the elements of consent at the time that he spoke with the evaluee. The evaluee understood and acknowledged and gave consent that the report could be shared with the VA, could be shared with the parents. And so I admit, and I'm sure that Dr. Bruner will admit, that it's always preferred practice to have a signed consent. But I think under Arizona law, our Arizona statutes, and under APA, that it is adequate or sufficient to simply do that in an oral way and then memorialize it in one's notes. And I believe that was done here.
That's all I have. Thank you. Any other questions for Dr. Bruner or Mr. Akins? Hearing none, let's begin our deliberation process. So keep in mind that deliberation is the time for committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, or attorneys representing the licensees. Dr. Gill, since you are the lead, do you want to begin the deliberation?
Well, as Dr. Bruner pointed out, I think it was a mistake and an oversight on his part that he didn't get the signatures of the parents, though he did document the oral explanation and sign that document. I believe that Dr. Bruner adequately explained why a report was not sent to them at the appropriate time, and it does seem reasonable to try to set up an appointment to review the report itself and to discuss all the issues that relate to that report to the family, though they were initially resistant to that. With that, I really don't see a violation here, and I'm thinking in terms of a dismissal.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. I agree with your assessment of that. Dr. Catrino, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I was a little concerned with the length of time after the records were received and the informed consent not being signed, but I also think we can dismiss the case.
All right. Then I will make a motion to dismiss case 21-23. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. There is a motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. There are none opposed. The motion passes. Thank you, Mr. Akins, and thank you, Dr. Bruno, for being here.
Thank you for your time.
All right, so let's move on to the next complaint, which is number 21-26 for Nicholas Heineke. Again, if I'm mispronouncing the name, please correct me. Dr. Gill, since you're the lead committee member on this complaint, would you please provide an overview?
Thank you, Mr. Dinar. This complaint was with regard to Nicholas Heineke. I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly. I am. Okay, I got a positive handshake. I just want to let people know that I am a Vietnam vet myself, so maybe that's why I'm the lead on these VA cases. Now, Dr. Heineke received his degree from Nova Southeastern University in 2009. He's currently licensed up until April the 30th of 2022. And my understanding is he's now residing in Arizona, or at least he has a practice operating in Arizona. Now, Dr. Heineke was with, and perhaps still is, with the VA healthcare systems in different capacities for 13 years. Now, Dr. Heineke, from 2017, was the program manager and supervising psychologist for the VA's outpatient PTSD clinic in Kansas City, and has become licensed in Arizona recently. From 2017 to 2020, he was also a member of the executive training committee, also described as ETC, for an APA-accredited internship program and an APA postdoc fellowship at the PTSD clinic at the Kansas City VA. Now, MD is the complainant, and MD is a postdoc fellow at the Kansas City VA. In June of 2021, MD filed a complaint alleging that KM, another well, she's not a postdoc fellow anymore, but she recently was, and she's a PsyD. She was involved in a romantic relationship with MD's supervisor, that's Dr. Heineke. Dr. Heineke claimed in response that he began dating KM in October of 2020, 9 months after his supervision of KM ended. Now, I have an events timeline from July the 22nd of 2019 to January the 16th, 2020. KM completed an internship rotation at the PTSD clinic in the Kansas City VA, where Dr. Heineke was the supervisor, her supervisor. During the internship, Dr. Heineke and KM didn't spend time together socially or outside of work. He described the relationship as, quote, strictly professional, unquote. Dr. Heineke submitted a letter of reference for KM as part of a fellowship application on December the 2nd, 2019. While KM was completing her internship, Dr. Heineke, on December the 19th of 2019, formally resigned by email from the executive training committee, effective immediately, and resigned as a training officer after completion of the internship training year on July the 17th, 2020. Now, August the 17th of 2020, KM began a postdoc at the PTSD clinic that ended in February the 26th of 2021. KM was supervised by a staff psychologist, part of the PTSD clinical team, who reported directly to the training director and a second line supervisor. According to MD, KM began, quote, communicating with Dr. Heineke outside of work beginning in September of 2020. Now, there was also an anonymous complaint that was submitted to the board on August the 6th, 2021. So the board received this anonymous complaint by mail. And the point of this complaint was that when KM completed her postdoc, her supervisor was, I'm going to call her Dr. JC, who in turn was supervised by Dr. Heineke. When Dr. JC was unavailable, according to the anonymous source, Dr. Heineke was KM's supervisor during her rotation. So there was also emphasis on the MD complaint from September the 2nd, 20, well, I'm sorry, of 20 and December the 3rd, or September the 3rd, KM informed MD that Dr. Heineke had been communicating to KM by text, requesting KM spend time with him outside of work. And that's the end of my report regarding this case.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. So I think the complainant MD is present. So would you please speak up and state your initials for the record? And you have the opportunity to make a brief statement if you wish, of up to 5 minutes, or you may have the committee members ask you questions at this time. And just to give a few preliminaries from the beginning of the meeting, if you're going to speak about yourself or anyone else, please only use their initials. And if there are any confidential information, we might like to go into executive session to discuss that. But you don't have to. So, MD, you may proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. My initials are MD. I do not have any additional statements to make at this time. I believe my concerns are adequately addressed by my complaint, as well as additional information that was provided to the committee by one of my supervisors, Dr. Clausen, who has also phoned into this meeting with us today. I would like to note, Dr. Gill, I believe you mentioned that Dr. Heineke was my supervisor during my postdoctoral training, but that is not the case. I was supervised by Dr. Clausen, as well as Dr. Veitch, who is another psychologist at the Kansas City VA. And I am more than happy to answer any questions that you all have for me today.
Thank you. Dr. Gill or Dr. Caterino, do you have questions?
Yes, Dr. Just a quick question. Was Dr. Heineke the supervisor of your supervisor?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I have a question then. Dr. Heineke, did you sign any training plans for KM, either for internship training plan or postdoc training plan?
Dr. Caterino, do we want to, first see if you have any questions for MD?
I'm sorry, I don't have any.
So then let's see if Dr. Heineke, and I think he's present here with his attorney, Mr. Akins. So let's see if one of them wishes to make a statement before we ask them any questions.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. So Dr. Heineke, Mr. Akins, do you have any statement to make at this time, or would you like to answer questions?
I'll just start by going on the record to say that I'm Theron Akins. I'm counsel for the licensee, and he can introduce himself, and I know he does have some words. I hope that you'll provide a bit of flexibility with the timing on this, only because he's going to be responding to documents that were provided to the board staff at the very last minute that we haven't had an opportunity to formally respond to. So we were told we'd be given an opportunity to address them orally today.
Thank you, Mr. Akins. Dr. Heineke, you may proceed.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I'd like to thank the committee for allowing me the opportunity to speak on this matter here today. First, I want to highlight that the relationship with KM is consensual, it's positive, healthy, and in no way coercive or exploitive. We're both high-functioning psychologists providing good work with our patients, and our relationship has had no impact or influence on that clinical work. Prior to entering into the relationship, I consulted a number of different licensed psychologists to consider thoughtfully the various different ethical concerns that might arise. No one objected, and there's never been any sanctions or admonishments. And today is my first opportunity to have to speak to anyone regarding their personal concerns regarding this matter. Third, I could understand and appreciate requests for clarifying questions regarding the chain of command and backup type supervision. I'd like to highlight that during KM's postdoctoral fellowship, I was never her supervisor and was never her second line supervisor and never provided backup for her. I had no influence over her clinical work. I had no influence over her professional pursuits or the ability to influence her clinical supervisor's supervision. I was thoughtful in thinking about potential conflicts of interest, and there was always plenty of available clinical coverage available that didn't include me. To add, we recently had a fellow complete the rotation on the clinic, and while he was on the rotation, I didn't have any interaction with him at all. I add that just to say that it's not uncommon for the program manager to have little or no contact with the various residents, fellows, rotating doctors, or nurses that may be on the unit at any given time. Fourth, this matter has already been investigated and discussed by various individuals and organizations. There's never been any sanctions or admonishments, not from my boss at the VA, all the way up to the director of the Kansas City VA itself, and onward to the Office of Academic Affairs for the whole VA, which covers all different types of training, not just psychologists, but also nurses and doctors, et cetera. And apparently APA was also contacted and performed some type of investigative review and recommended an informal resolution. As the VA is part of training of psychologists, they adopt the ethics code and rules for professional conduct and behavior. And that can be evidenced throughout the fellow's handbook highlighting the ethics codes. It's important to highlight the VA did do its appropriate investigation, and they determined that since the relationship was consensual and I was not KM's supervisor, they were not in a position to tell any employees who they can and cannot date. And therefore, the determination was that the VA did not see any VA violation or APA violation. It's again important to note that during the fellowship year, KM is neither a student nor was she my supervisee. She received her doctoral degree over a year ago and decided to complete this elective fellowship at the Kansas City VA over pursuing other available staff positions in the VA or at the community at large. During her fellowship, I didn't provide her supervision. I had no form of evaluative or administrative power over her. Thus, this complaint doesn't rise to the level of sexual exploitation or of coercive harm or impairment. Instead, it's something that's been very positive, healthy, and supportive. KM has now completed her fellowship, and we both look forward to continuing the fine work we're doing with veterans in the Kansas City area and put this matter behind us. Late last week, the board received a submission from, we'll say, Dr. JC, And I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to just speak a little bit longer regarding that. Much of what Dr. JC wrote is repetitive and has already been addressed. So I'm going to just focus on a couple key pieces. Dr. JC seemed to want to continue an assertion that I was a second line supervisor of KM. This simply isn't the role of a program manager. A second line supervisor at the VA is going to have some type of evaluative authority of someone else's work two steps below. So for example, I might complete a performance evaluation for Dr. GD, and my boss, Dr. MM, as the second line supervisor, has the evaluative authority to sign off and approve my appraisal or disapprove of appraisal for that matter. For fellows, it's similar. Their initial clinical supervisor is going to provide that evaluative performance appraisal. And then if there's any necessary concerns about that, that would go on to the training director, as the training director is the one verifying hours for APA, licensure, and the one that fellows would go to with any concerns. It's simply not part of the program manager's duty to have any role or evaluative authority in any of the training, whether it be psychologists or the various other trainees at one time. Second, Dr. JC also raised some questions about a backup supervision for her. Previously, I had provided the board some documentation regarding all of her absences, and all of those indicate that the covering supervisor was Dr. GD, and he would have been the one to sign off on all of KM's clinical documentation. And at no time was I a backup supervisor. Because of my role as Dr. JD's direct supervisor, I haven't asked him for a statement regarding this matter, as I feared that might not be completely appropriate. But I did offer the board his contact information if it's important to follow up with him. The final point from Dr. JC's submission was suggesting that I met with her individually regarding KM's supervision, regarding her cases, regarding her clinical progress. That simply isn't true. I've not had any individual case conversations with Dr. JC. I haven't met with her individually regarding KM. And if any of those types of opportunities would have presented themselves, I would have easily declined them and offered an alternative solution, such as speaking with a different psychologist, either in the clinic or in the training program. It simply wouldn't be my role as program manager to discuss clinical work with Dr. JC. I want to make sure that the committee understands that I denied these comments. Such meetings simply didn't happen. And I'd like to conclude my statement here this morning, again stating that the relationship with KM has been consensual. It's not been coercive. It's not been exploitive, but it's been, in fact, something very positive, healthy, and wonderful. Thank you for taking the time for listening to me this morning and reviewing my documentation, and hopefully that you might consider dismissing this matter. And I'm happy to be available for any additional questions that you might have.
Thank you, Dr. Heinecke. Any questions for Dr. Heinecke at this time? Yes, Dr. Kim.
I believe that the complainant had made a remark, Dr. Heinecke, in which you were the, during the time of KM's postdoc, that you were the supervisor of the supervisor. And I wonder if you could comment on that. Were you in the line of possibly being accessed or potentially accessed information, clinical information regarding her work with the VA?
So yes, it's correct that I would have been the supervisor in the clinic for KM's clinical supervisor, but as the role of the program manager, I wouldn't be involved in that clinical piece. It gets a little convoluted, so hopefully I've answered that. If you need more clarification, I can attempt.
So at no time did you act as the supervisor over KM's work while at the same time you engaged in a romantic relationship with her. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
And I guess I was going to ask questions about Dr. JC's email, but I think you addressed a lot of them. Do you or your attorney, do you feel you need more time to digest the information that email, or do you feel like it's you've completed your review and feel confident?
Well, we've discussed
moving forward.
We've discussed this at length, even with the short period of time we've had to address it. I think we're comfortable that we came prepared today to address the concerns in the anonymous letter as well as the earlier one. And again, if there's any questions or any issues that anyone on the committee wants to address, we're prepared to answer that. If there's something that we can't answer because we need other information in order to do so, we can always indicate that for you.
Well, maybe I have another question. Dr. Henneke, do you feel that, or do you have a comment on whether KM might have been showed preferential treatment during the time of your romantic relationship at the VA because of her relationship with you?
It's a good question. I'd be able to comment that I don't think that's the case at all. And I think actually because of this complaint, she's had the opposite treatment at the VA.
Okay. Also in the Dr. JC email, you're described as KM's mentor in the present tense. Do you have a comment about that?
Yeah, I can't really say more than I'm not exactly sure what that means, other than that I did was her supervisor on internship and provided that letter of recommendation for those 6 months where she spent about 12 hours in the clinic per week.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Henneke.
Mm-hmm.
So the question I had was, so on the internship training plan and the postdoc training plan, are you listed as a supervisor on either one?
For internship, yes, I was. I'm not listed and not part of the training or the postdoctoral fellowship, no.
And the internship ended when?
That would have ended in January 2020.
So it was from July to January?
Yes.
Okay. And then the, there was one other question I was going to ask you. Oh, so then you began dating the next year, like February.
It was October 2020 then.
Okay. And... well, I think that was the main question. Oh, I know. The one day where JC said that she hadn't been able to reach KM and she had to leave. And then you said that JM only found you to talk to about her for supervision that day. I know you addressed that in an email, but would you like to just say a little more about that one day?
Sure. Yeah. And I think Dr. Davis submitted some information on that too. Dr. JC apparently had been out of the clinic and didn't advise KM that she was going to be gone. And KM alerted me that JC was gone and that she had found Dr. GD to be her supervisor. So it was just kind of appraising me of the situation that there was appropriate coverage.
So at no point did you provide supervision that day?
Correct. No.
Okay. Or any other day in the postdoc. Thank you.
Correct.
Yes, Dr. Gill.
I just have a follow-up question. There was a reference in the materials that we reviewed regarding, quote, repeated texts between you and KM. I know that you had made a comment in your response that was not so, but I wondered if you want to take this opportunity to further comment on inappropriate texting or phone calling or outside social contacts at inappropriate times when you held another role in relationship to KM. Could you comment?
Sure. Yeah. During internship, while she was my supervisee, we didn't have any contact other than for professional purposes. I believe there was maybe a couple of texts possibly after she completed internship related to her selection of which postdoctoral training program she wanted to attend. And then in terms of more of a social relationship, that discussion, that texting or phone calls didn't happen until in October-ish time in 2020. Sorry, I got the year mixed up.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So looks like there are no further questions for Dr. Heinicke or Mr. Akins. So we will proceed with the deliberation. Keep in mind that the deliberation is the time for the committee members to deliberate the case amongst themselves without interruptions from the complainants, licensees, or attorneys representing the licensees. So Dr. Gill, since you're the lead, would you want to begin the deliberation?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Dinar. Well, in a careful review of this case, there were some concerns that I had in reading this thing through. I was particularly concerned after looking at Dr. JC's email. There's nothing else. There's no other evidence to kind of support that email in terms of the role that Dr. Heinicke may have played. And I find it powerful that he had already been reviewed by the committee or at the VA, and they did not find an inappropriate relationship that he engaged in. And one question I didn't ask was whether there's a board inquiry in Missouri regarding this issue. Aside from that, I think this case should be dismissed.
I agree, Dr. Gill, with everything you said.
Dr. Katrin or Dr. Gill, I agree as well. I was looking at subsection F, and I don't see anything that meets that definition. So is there a motion?
Yeah, I make the motion that we dismiss this case.
I second that. There's a motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. None opposed. The motion passes. The case is dismissed. Thank you, Dr. Heinicke, for being here. Thank you, Mr. Akins.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So let's move on to the next complaint on the agenda. Just wanted to make sure if anyone needs a comfort break so we can do two cases after a break, or we can do this case and take a break and then come back for the final case on the agenda. All right, well, let's march on. The next complaint to be discussed is number T-21-03 for Josh Smith. Dr. Catarino, since you're the lead, would you please provide the committee with an overview?
Okay, so in February of 2021, the board looked at a temporary license application for Dr. John Szyszapluski. And in his materials, he submitted a letter from Dr. Josh Smith, that Dr. Smith indicated in the letter that he would be his postdoctoral supervisor and that he was fully qualified to do so. So Dr. Smith's resume or whatever was looked at, his credentials were investigated, and it was found that he was not a licensed psychologist. He did have a school psychology certification from 2014, and in 2018, Dr. Smith had applied for the exam and licensure, and had twice not been able to meet the passport requirement. So he is not a licensed psychologist in Arizona. So then Dr. Szyszapluski, I'm sorry, I'm not saying that right. indicated that he made a mistake and he didn't mean to put that letter in. That was a letter that he thought he might use for school psych certification. And he submitted a different letter from Dr. Mather indicating that he was the postdoc supervisor. But since we had seen that letter, that brought up some concerns by the board. So then the board investigated Dr. Smith's record. So we did see that he had a doctorate in school psychology from Argosy University in June 2018. We saw that in 2016, he incorporated his company, Horizon Psychological Services, LLC. Later, this is referred to as Horizon Education and Psychological Services. So that was a concern because the word psychological services was in there. And given that there was no other psychologist listed on Horizon's website, we didn't know how Horizon would be providing psychological services. There was a suggestion that the exemption for school psychologists indicates that school psychologists can use the term school psychologist while they are working and employed by a school, high school or charter school setting. And that is appropriate to use that while they're in the school. So on the Horizon website, it doesn't indicate that is a school. Now that website has been taken down, but we looked at it prior. So there's no indication that these evaluations were done while the provider was working in a school. The original Horizon website also indicated that they provided psychological evaluations. So Dr. Smith was directed to take that down, but in his Facebook account, there's a Facebook account for Horizon, and it still indicates that evaluations are completed there. And so it does, and there was a point that Horizon only worked with charter schools or had some state programs that they worked with, but I didn't understand then why they would be advertising on Facebook, because that appeared to me to be a public, looking for public advertisement for people from the public to come to his services. So I also, there was a question of the services that were employed, and Dr. Smith provided a sample independent contractor agreement with Legacy Charter Schools. And in that he refers to that he would perform all the psychological duties at the school. And there's a question about psychological evaluation. So that was referred to also. And that's all I wanted to mention now. But the main thing is we see that they're using the term itself. The name of the company is psychological. And I thought that was pretty interesting right there. So that's where we're at right now.
Thank you, Dr. Catrino. So I see Dr. Smith is present with his attorney, Ms. Sarah Stark. So this would be a time for you to provide a brief statement, if you wish, of up to 5 minutes, or you may just have the committee ask you questions at this time.
Hi, yes, this is Sarah Stark, and good morning, or almost afternoon, and I represent Dr. Smith in this matter. I'll just briefly address some of the issues raised, and then we'll turn it over to the committee members for questions they may have. So Horizon is the business through which Dr. Smith contracts with schools to provide services as a school psychologist within a school setting. So as a certified school psychologist, Dr. Smith is exempt from licensure pursuant to ARS section 32-2075A1. As he is employed in a school setting, he's nationally certified through the National Association of School Psychologists and is also certified to use the title by the Arizona Department of Education. And furthermore, the services are provided as part of Dr. Smith's employment contracts with individual schools. Pursuant to the contracts with the various schools, all evaluations provided are done within a school setting and specifically within the actual buildings of the school. So with regard to the concerns raised about the marketing materials, including the website and Facebook page, Dr. Smith has acknowledged the board's concerns and has taken down both his website and, as of this morning, his Facebook page as well in order to address these concerns. Dr. Smith is taking the issues raised by board staff and the committee members very seriously. He has reassessed aspects of his business to ensure that he's not violating any of the board's rules or statutes. He has also completed 12 hours of continuing education, which includes a course on supervision. And I will provide those certificates to Ms. Michelson after the meeting. And finally, he's fully committed to cooperating with the board in order to address any concerns in his current practice as he works towards obtaining his license. In furtherance of his goals for future licensure with the board, respondent has opted to take a sabbatical from, his work with Dr. Mather and only work with his school contract one day a week, so that he can focus on studying for his EEPP exam. He believes he is currently compliant with the board's rules, but is willing to take any additional steps requested or required by the board at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stark. Dr. Smith, do you want to make a statement or do you wish to answer questions?
No, just thank you, everybody, for allowing me to address the concerns and the complaints of this committee. Just like Ms. Stark reiterated, my whole intent wasn't to harm or deceive the public at all. You know, my horizon was really an educational and consultative business, educational business, where I can work through and coordinate with other school districts, since, you know, school psychologists and aware of that. So, but I'm open to questions with the committee and be happy to answer anything you guys have.
Thank you. I have a question, but I'll have Dr. Catrino ask questions first.
Okay, so Ms. Michelson asked for some sample evaluations. I believe some were, at least one was of an adult. I think it was a 22-year-old person. Was that person in the school?
No, so request was some from school setting, from Horizon. The other half were from Arizona Neuropsychology Centers, where I receive and work under the direction of Dr. Mather. So I believe the adult was from that private practice.
Okay. And then there was an email from a clerical worker at the site where the parent asked for Dr. Mather to go to Tucson. And the person said, well, no, that Dr. Smith is the only psychologist that will travel. Referring to you in that way.
Correct. I would help out and travel. We had a couple satellite offices. We don't have them anymore, but and it was really for the convenience of the client under Arizona Neuropsychology Centers. So we gave them an option.
But you did refer to you as psychologist?
I didn't respond to that. So was that the office manager?
Someone in the office.
You know, and that was probably an oversight on her end. You know, up front, you know, if it was a consultation or a phone call, I mean, everything was verbalized as far as, you know, my role at Arizona Neuropsychology Centers, and I wasn't fully licensed, and I was there for, you know, postdoc and receiving that supervision under Dr. Mather. And clients always had access to Dr. Mather in any shape or form that if they needed, there's any concern.
But when you originally began Horizon Psychological Services, was there any licensed psychologist, you know, connected with that company?
No.
And how did you feel it was appropriate to use the word psychological services in your title of your company?
So in 2016, I opened Horizon and figured out quickly, that name was misleading. So I did actually add the educational. So from my point, I was thinking I'm a school psychologist, still doing some psychological, school psych work, and kept the name since then.
But you added educational, right? You didn't take away psychological, which is a protected term.
Well, as far as education and psychological services.
You added education, but you never removed psychological.
Correct.
And psych or psychological is a protected term used only for licensees.
But in the school setting, my website has changed over time, and that's, I think what you guys see now is what paid an individual to revamp my website. So back then it wasn't as detailed and very basic. So, yes.
Well, I'm not even referring to the website. I'm referring to the incorporation of the company, of Horizon. It was incorporated with the term psychological.
And since then, I've taken down my website, too. That is,
but have you changed the corporation title?
I have not.
Okay. I may have more questions, but I'll let Dr. Gill and Mr. Diner now for a bit.
Thank you, Dr. Catrino. Dr. Gillia.
Yes. It does appear, especially after taking down the Facebook page, that you're making efforts to try to correct this and to not to misrepresent or mislead others into thinking that you're a licensed psychologist. That's maybe the biggest concern. It looks like the focus is on the past. I know this board has spent a lot of time reviewing these issues. I don't feel the need to go over it again, but there was a concern that you were the supervisor for a postdoc, and and during your supervisory time, you were at least the allegation is that those hours were going to be used towards his application for licensure. And do you acknowledge that that takes place? And have you, since that time, addressed that issue?
Yes, we've addressed that issue. And Dr. Chaplesky has actually been cleared to move forward. I was his site supervisor in the schools. And then Dr. Mather oversaw everything as far as,
So you didn't, it wasn't documented that any supervision that you provided for him at the level of psychology, not school psychology, was not, that information was not passed along to the board as part of his application for licensure.
I believe they submitted a letter stating the arrangements. I'll have to double check with that. I don't know Dr. Chaplesky's case overall, but as far as referring back to the letter in the beginning of, I think it was submitted back in June or July last year. It was really a clerical error on my end when we put the agreement together. It was something I just took from Dr. Mather's and I's agreement and just replaced the name. So that was definitely an oversight on my end. And I totally understand that I cannot supervise Dr. Chaplesky as a school psychologist.
Yeah, the final point is the appearance, I think, before the board, I guess speaking for myself anyway, is that there was some kind of incestuous relationship between Horizon is it AZ Neuropsychology? Mm-hmm. I would hope that you are now in trying to correct insufficiencies that you are clear that you have to be distinct from them. You cannot be kind of ambiguously a single entity if you're going to provide school psychology services, fine, but you cannot you want to be clear that this is what you're doing, that this is, and that everybody that you're providing services for understands your role and understands that you're not a licensed psychologist to practice.
Correct. No, and I'm aware of that and been vocal with, you know, and relay that information with people that come into our office for sure. But at this point, I'm taking a sabbatical, and it is my, you know, direction moving forward once I do get licensed and move on from Dr. Mather in the practice.
Okay. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. So I have a few questions, and Ms. Stark or Dr. Smith, either one of you could answer. So what is the full name of the LLC, the Horizon LLC?
It's Horizon Educational Psychological Services.
Okay. And you had said, Dr. Smith, that you formed it, so you are, how does that relationship between you and the LLC, how would you define it?
Yeah, I opened it in 2016, the manager, I guess, of the LLC.
Mm-hmm. And when, as a school psychologist in a school setting, I would assume the contract is between a school district or a school and the LLC, correct?
Yes.
And does that contract specify that the psychologist services would be provided by you, or could the LLC designate anyone as the school psychologist?
Well, it was only a one-person contract with me. I'm not sure about the verbiage in those contracts as there were a year or two ago, but I was the sole person providing the school evaluation, school contract services.
So is your understanding that you signed that contract as an individual, or did you sign that on behalf of the LLC?
Well, Horizon is part of it. I think it's both.
So when the school district issues checks or payments for your services, are they in your name or in the LLC's name?
I'm gonna say they're in my name. I'm not 100% sure. Because I have multiple contracts with different schools in the past. Right now, I'm only contracted with one school district. I want to say it is my name. But it's associated with Horizon.
And that's what I'm trying to get at is, you know, are you the person holding out to be a psychologist outside of the school setting, or are you not? That's really the question I'm trying to get at.
Sorry, will you ask me that again? Will you restate that?
So what I'm trying to get at is, are you a person who is holding out to be a psychologist outside of a school setting, or is it the LLC that is just simply advertising, you know, psychological services in general?
Well, the website was intended for, you know, educational psychological services as me as a school psychologist. You know, and like I said, that was my oversight with the verbiage on my website, so I took it down. But when I contract with the school districts, I'm direct contract, you know. But my consultative educational business is still Horizon. Does that make sense? Am I answering your question?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to understand what those several relationships look like, because there's a legal relationship between you and the LLC. There's a legal relationship between you and a school or multiple schools, and there's a legal relationship apparently between the LLC and a school or multiple schools or a school district. So I'm just trying to understand the lay of the land there. That's all the questions I have.
I have a couple more that I forgot to ask.
Yes, okay. Dr. Katrina and then Dr. Gill.
Okay, so, you know, you say that the title of the corporation is now changed. But that's changed in just how you refer to it. Has it been changed by the in the Corporation Commission where you first filed it?
No, I have not. That's why I've taken down the website.
Yeah, no, but it's still incorporated as Horizon Psychological Services.
Correct.
The functions that you perform psychological evaluations, I see in the few that were pulled out and sent to us, several of these you were supervised by Dr. Mather. On the gifted evaluation of a four-year-old, it only has your signature, not Dr. Mather's. Isn't that a psychological evaluation without any supervision? Was that done in a school?
No, it was actually done in a school. Sorry. That was actually an oversight that he didn't have a signature on there. It was performed in the office. Dr. Mather was present during that evaluation in the office.
But he didn't sign it.
Yeah, there was no signature on his end. That was, an oversight on my end.
Did you have other clients where, I wondered if this gifted eval came from a school district because he was only four. I mean, did you have other clients that just from the general public or would you say that all your clients came from a school?
Clients as far as?
That you did evaluations on. Horizon.
Arizona and Earth. So all evaluations through Horizon were contracted through school district. So if I was there for a certain amount of time, part-time, 3 days a week, through IEP Pro, I'm going to be in the school setting. I was physically in the school setting.
Okay. So if a person called up, saw your website and called up and said, I'm concerned about my child, I would like you to conduct an evaluation through Horizon, what do you do?
Well, talk about services and not services, talk about options and then refer them. So sometimes it goes back to the school setting or other psychologists, either under Arizona Neuropsychology. I mean, I've sent to Dr. Gentry, multiple offices. It's really that consultative piece and having parents understand their options and refer them out.
So, because I saw that if you would like a neuropsych, we would refer you to Dr. Mather, it had said on the website, something to that effect. But it didn't say anything about that for psychological evaluations. So you're saying that if they called up, you would not complete a psychological evaluation at the Horizon office?
Correct.
Okay. And so this gifted one was just an oversight?
As far as the signature, correct. It was through our Arizona Neuropsychs. They called in, scheduled, and then did the evaluation under Dr. Mather's supervision. Even within the center there with Dr. Mather, he would greet and meet. We would do an intake session. Parents were fully aware of my enrollment or my involvement and supervision under Dr. Mather. At Arizona Neuropsychology Centers.
Okay. I looked at what I recall looking at the website or the Facebook. I'm not sure. It never really gave your credentials on the Facebook. It just said you will meet with Dr. Smith. It was ambiguous. I don't recall you saying psychologist or school psychologist on that Facebook account. Is that correct?
That's possible. I took down the website just because it was the complaint and misleading. I can see that on your guys' end. So I guess my intent is to clean all this up and move forward and become licensed. So I don't want any of this to be out there. So I appreciate you guys bringing these concerns to me.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Gill?
I just have one question. Dr. Smith, regarding these satellite offices that you had, how many satellite offices did you have in the state?
It varied. Some of them were like Regis offices you rent for the day. Some were a church, So it's really just helping the parents out if they couldn't drive or, the financial situation. My heart, just really wanted to help low-income families in those areas, Tucson and Yuma and things like that. So. But I didn't do a lot of them, probably one or two a month.
And those were school psychology assessments of some form?
No, those were through Arizona Neuropsychology.
Oh, okay. And But you can, okay, so you conducted the evaluations?
Yes.
Okay. That's all the questions I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. So it looks like we have no further questions for Ms. Stark or Dr. Smith. So the committee will begin deliberation. Please keep in mind that this is the time for the committee members to deliberate the case amongst themselves without interruptions from the respondents or the attorneys representing the respondent. So Dr. Catrino, since you're the lead, do you want to begin the deliberation process?
Yeah, I think this should be referred to the board as a whole. I'm concerned with the use of the title and on the website listing psychological services, the corporation commission, a title of Horizon Psychological Services, and then at least one evaluation here where it was provided with only Dr. Smith's signature. So I would like it to go to the full board.
And I would agree.
I agree as well. So is that a motion, Dr. Catarino?
Yes, I move that we bring this case to the full board for discussion.
And for a possible violation of what statute?
Oh.
2084.
Thank you. Yes. Okay, so I move that it go to the full board for a possible violation of 2084?
Correct, 2084.
I'd like to say also that I acknowledge Dr. Smith's effort to try to clean up, what he has done, and I think that should be taken into account as well. However, I don't think the screening committee can ignore what has occurred, and for that reason, I support the motion to go before the board.
I assume, Dr. Gill, that was a second.
I'm sorry.
Motion and a second. I wish to discuss a little bit. I agree, Dr. Gill, that Dr. Smith has taken efforts to correct most of those things. And in my mind, there is a potentially mitigating, if not an erasing factor, which is our statute 2075 relating to school psychologists. So depending on any additional information that we get from Dr. Smith and Ms. Stark as to how exactly that relationship worked out, if there is evidence showing that the only setting in which Dr. Smith provided psychological services was in a school setting as a school psychologist, then that, in my mind, would answer the question of whether Dr. Smith committed a title violation. But again, I did not hear any specific answer to how those relationships and how those contracts were spelled out. So I'd like to see that information. So I would be in support of the motion just because I think there needs to be some further factual development that's needed. Ms. Galvin, do you prefer that we do some sort of a direction to staff to obtain more information, or should we just, vote on the motion and that should take care of it?
I think the staff and Ms. Stark have heard your message, and the referral can be made to the board with an understanding that once it is, or when it gets to the board, additional information will have been provided for everyone's review.
Thank you, Ms. Galvin. All right, then. There is a motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. None opposed. The motion passes. Thank you, Dr. Smith, for being here. Thank you, Ms. Stark.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, then. Do the committee members and our board staff wish to take a break? I can All right.
We have much more.
Reluctant.
Oh, we have one more. Taking a break. I would rather go ahead, but it's up to you.
I just need a 5-minute comfort break.
Okay, then we can do that.
5 and come back by maybe 12:15. Let's get started. I see Dr. Gill and Dr. Catrino are back from the break, as are our excellent board staff. So the last complaint to be discussed today is number 21-14 for Suzanne Mumby. This case was reviewed by the committee at the July 21st meeting. The committee had voted to table the matter because there were questions for Dr. Mumby and she did not attend that meeting. Dr. Mumby notified the board approximately 15 minutes before the July 21st meeting that she was ill and unable to attend. I hope you're feeling better, Dr. Mumby. The committee directed board staff to issue a subpoena to Dr. Mumby for her appearance at today's meeting. Dr. Mumby confirmed with the board staff by email on August 2nd that she received the subpoena. Dr. Malott was previously the lead for this case, but because she is not serving on today's complaint screening committee, I will provide a brief summary for the case. So this case comes out of a situation where there was miscommunication, or it seems to be that there was miscommunication, a lot of it, between Dr. Mumby and the complainants, her employer. So the complaining parties are her previous or current employers. That's sort of unknown at this point what exactly the employer-employee relationship looks like. But the board's job is not really to regulate that relationship necessarily, but to see if those miscommunications have led to some violations of our statutes. Now, the underlying problem with the miscommunications was that, or at least the allegation from the complainants is that Dr. Mumby did not properly reach out to her patients in a timely manner to ensure that there was continuity of service. Dr. Mumby has provided a statement addressing that issue on August 16th, and that is in our materials, which we have reviewed. So at this point, we are looking to see if the underlying allegation that Dr. Mumby did not reach out to the patients constitutes a violation of our statutes or any ethics rules that are applicable to psychologists. So that is the summary of my complaint, or summary of the complaint. I am not the complaining party, excuse me. So let's see, I don't think the complainants are present. Is that correct, Ms. Michelson?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. They indicated that they would not be participating today, but I do see that Dr. Mumby called in.
Thank you, yes. Dr. Mumby, if you could please speak up and state your full name for the record. And this is your opportunity to make a brief statement, or in lieu of a statement, you may wish to answer questions from the committee members. The committee members will have questions to ask you nonetheless. You may proceed. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, board. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. This is Suzanne Mumby, and I would like to make a very brief statement, just following up with my written statement, and I wonder if this would be an appropriate time to request a possible executive session, so I may speak freely on potentially confidential information.
Dr. Mumby, the only reason that we can go into executive session if there's protected health information that you need to discuss with the board or the committee.
Yes, that's what I anticipated. It may or may not come up during the committee's questions, so if maybe we should proceed with just the questions and see how that goes, but I do have a concern being I might need some privacy, if possible.
There's a difference between privacy and protected health information. So keep that in mind. If you want to go ahead and make a statement that does not contain protected health information, then we can go ahead and do that. If there's other information that you want to disclose that you believe is protected health information, then we can go into executive session.
I'll make a general statement. And we can go from there. Basically, my statement, just to follow up, like I said, on the written statement, is that I believe if we are able to examine the situation as it was presented in the very beginning in September of 2020, based on the information that I had and how I proceeded, I believe that I didn't violate any ethical codes of conduct, unprofessional conduct. In hindsight, could I have done better? Of course. However, I do believe that based on my understanding of leaving with an approval from HR for only 2 weeks, that I did proceed and reach out to my active patient caseload. And I did do my due diligence, making sure that there was any anticipated issues, concerns, coordination of care that was completed with the patients who I was actively working with in those anticipated 2 weeks. The amount of patients that I had was upward of 70, and it is unreasonable to be able to have an unexpected leave of absence and a request within 24 hours and to have no admin staff and to be able to have that responsibility. However, I did try to do my best to make sure there was no client abandonment issues whatsoever and did work very closely with my clinical supervisor, HC, and the few case managers and try to coordinate care as much as possible and do that due diligence. And I don't believe that any violations were committed. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Mumbi. So I have a few questions, if I may ask you. So at least as far as the committee is concerned, or at least as far as I'm concerned, I'm looking at our definition for unprofessional conduct, subsection B. Subsection V, as in violet, which says abandoning or neglecting a client or patient in need of immediate care without making suitable arrangements for continuation of the care. So could you tell me the efforts that you took in making sure that your patients received continuity of care when you went on leave of absence?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for asking. That is a very important situation. And of course, as clinicians, we need to absolutely avoid at all costs, even in a crisis. And I believe I did my due diligence and I informed my clinical supervisor of my concerns. And she referred me to HR to look at the options and concerns that might be addressed and the length of time to formulate a plan of action. So I put my clinical supervisor on alert, and I worked with them in order to have an approved exit plan that was temporary, and it was only supposed to be 2 weeks. So, and in that case, then she was taking over that supervision of the caseload, and then upon my realization that it would be longer than 2 weeks, I did immediately reach out to HR, as I wasn't allowed to communicate with the clinical team or any patients at that point. I did reach out to HR, and I did request by email, which is in the information that was submitted to the committee's review, that they then reassign my patients in order so that they can have timely services, that there is absolutely no delay. So therefore, I believe that I do, or I did meet that standard of providing coordination of care in a timely manner, and that there was no abandonment concerns.
Thank you for your response. Were there any patients at that time who needed, in your opinion, immediate care so that, you know, they needed some that, you know, that would indicate to me whether you needed to take any additional steps to make sure that their needs or their continuity of care is adequately taken into account.
I do recall one patient. I don't recall the names. I can't provide any initials. But this patient was a fairly new patient, and I did actually schedule to meet with this patient and the mother to follow up. And I did conduct a risk assessment and a crisis plan, and I coordinated. I didn't facilitate the meeting with the case manager, but I coordinated that a follow up meeting with the case manager, and the case manager would be checking in with said patient. So for that instance, I did believe that 2 weeks even without care was not in the patient's best interest, and that's why the risk assessment was completed and more assistance and services were provided for that patient's care. And my understanding that there have been no complaints provided at all by the complainant from any of the patients.
So, Dr. Mumbi, the allegations that the complainants have made against you say that there were, that from their perspective, they had asked you to reach out to all of your patients to make sure the patients know that they are going to be treated by someone else. Could you speak to that allegation, and what's your understanding of how the series of events unfolded at that point?
Yes, absolutely. And I appreciate you asking, actually, because I reviewed the emails again, and actually I believe I'm the one who put that very strong word of all patients in the email as my response to the committee. That was never a directive from my clinical supervisor, HC, to contact every single patient and document on every single patient. And so when I responded with my written response to the committee, and remember, I haven't had any access to patient charts. This has been months after the fact. And knowing I did my due diligence, I actually used that word all, and I think I used it mistakenly. So basically, when we have the very large caseload, as I'm sure the committee is familiar with, there are going to be inactive patients. There's going to be patients who are in between and some who are active, and then, of course, those that are in need of even more intensive services. And so what I did was I went through all of my patients and assessed where they were, and essentially like a chart review. And I think that's where I take responsibility. I may have miscommunicated to the board my efforts in doing that. It wasn't that I called everybody, because there was quite a few patients who were not active at all. So I do apologize for that, and see how that may have misled even the board from our last hearing into down a path that is important to ask. But I may have had a part in misleading and unintentionally, and I apologize for that.
Thank you, Dr. Mumbi. That's all the questions I have. Let's see if Dr. Gill or Dr. Catrino has any questions. Yes, Dr. Catrino.
I just have this question. So there were 70 people on your 70 clients on your caseload. Is that correct?
There was upward of 70. Yes. I remember, saying to a coworker that I'm nearing 80, and I just could not believe it. So I don't know the exact number, but it was in the 70s.
And how many would you consider active?
Oh boy. I do apologize to the board.
Pardon me for interrupting. In my review, I think it was 46 or 47.
That's a number that was provided, but unfortunately, I don't have access to the client charts or the names, only the initials. I don't
all
know.
All the information we have.
I don't know how to respond to that. I had a fair amount, and not everyone was seen every week. So when I say active, I was referring to the 2 weeks that I would be out for those appointments that need to be rescheduled into high intensity patients, and for those patients who still were active that may request an appointment, that they just needed to be notified that I would be out. In other words, they might not be seen, but just providing a plan, reminding them, you know, to call in. There's another provider if they need, or if there's a case manager, if it's an adolescent patient. So again, it was a small time frame, so I can't say how many, but it definitely wasn't upwards of 40. But I did do a chart review of all my patients.
So how did you determine who was active and who was inactive? What was your criteria?
Good question. Thank you. So basically, it really isn't my criteria so much. It's basically the complainant's criteria, that if they don't respond after two calls or two outreaches, something to that effect, then they go into the inactive by the third call. So if they're not actively responding, there's not something that's scheduled in the future, if they haven't filled out the required paperwork online, those types of things. If they're not responsive. Unfortunately, that is very common.
So of the roughly 40, how many did you contact?
Probably at least, I'd say more than 10, probably upwards of 20, maybe more. Again, these were even just letting them know that I would be out, like a courtesy call. I didn't have an assistant, and that is just the way this agency operates, that providers don't have an assistant. So it was a very different role for me. I've never had to do that before, but I did do my due diligence and inform them out of courtesy. So I would say upward of probably maybe 20.
And how did you determine those? Those were people that had an appointment within those 2 weeks. Is that it?
Yes, the people who did absolutely have the appointment, for sure. There were a handful of ones who were very eager, very engaged for weekly therapy, but there's probably honestly only about 5 or 6 that I can recall that were every week, that were very consistent. They had no shows. We had to provide that notification, and I did that with a phone call.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Dr. Bill?
Thank you, Dr. Mumby, for being here. At what point was the electronic access, were you suspended from the electronic access? At what point?
Well, it was right away. I could pull up the...
I need to know what right away is.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry. I was pulling up the calendar, actually. I recall that it was a Monday. And if I look back, I believe I want to say the 28th of September. I will look. Yes, it was. So basically, the 25th is when I was wrapping things up. And I still had access, and the 28th is when IT went in. They changed the password, and I had no other access. I couldn't, and I was advised I could not contact any patients. So I had to contact me that reply.
So from the time that you reported that you would be out for 2 weeks, it happened. It sounds like it happened just within a week of your notification. Is that correct?
Yes, less than a week. Mm-hmm.
And do you feel, were you assuming that the documentation was going to be handled by the clinical director?
No, my documentation should be only handled by myself, which I did for the most part. Was I perfect? Absolutely not. Like I said, this was my first outpatient setting where I've never had an assistant. There was no admin support whatsoever, and we're telehealth in the middle of the pandemic. So I do not want to profess that I was perfect, especially as I was saying, going through my own medical concerns and not in a good place at that point. It was physically very difficult for me to do what I even did. So absolutely not. It was not.
Were you in a position to ask for help from the clinical director and maybe completing the documentation.
And thank you. That is something I learned from. Yes, that's what I learned from this experience, is that even though I only anticipated being out for 2 weeks, could I done even, gone a step further in my due diligence and say, hey, you know what, is it possible to have some more support and feel comfortable to do that? I think definitely. But at the point, like I said, doing the chart review, I felt for that short time frame that it wasn't a good place. I genuinely believe it wasn't a good place. All my patients, there was no crises. They were all low risk patients and stable. But yes, absolutely. And in the future, I will do that. I will learn from this and say, hey, we don't know what's going to happen, especially with medical conditions and treatment. I will definitely ask for more assistance to be thorough and make sure there's absolutely no holes.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Mumby.
You're welcome.
All right, it looks like we have asked all the questions we could ask of you, Dr. Mumby. So at this time, the committee will begin deliberations. Please note that the deliberation is the time for the committee members to discuss the case amongst themselves without interruptions from you, or I know you don't have an attorney. So since I'm the lead member for this case, I will begin the deliberation. So I think the facts presented in this case, we have had several lengthy discussions at this point. We have obtained extensive information from the complainants. They have been very forthcoming. And we have obtained information and a statement from Dr. Mumby as well. I feel the crux of the scenario we are presented with is in relation to whether Dr. Mumby abandoned or neglected a client or a patient who was in need of immediate care without making suitable arrangements for continuation of the care. And that's what our statute says. I am not aware of any American Psychological Association ethics rules that could potentially apply in this situation. Dr. Mumby has stated that she was going through some medical issues herself, and some of her family members were during this time. So that is, at least in my mind, definitely a factor that should be taken into consideration in deciding, you know, what Dr. Mumby did or did not do in the circumstances. As far as from the complainant's perspective, I can understand why there might be some frustration as to miscommunication between the employer and Dr. Mumby. I mean, I can imagine a situation where, let's say, Dr. Mumby reached out to a patient saying that, you know, they should contact the complainants to reschedule or schedule session with someone else, and the patient then, you know, contacts the employer, and now the employer is sort of on red alert, if you will, as to what to do in the circumstances. So the employer jumps, you know, possibly to the conclusion that Dr. Mumby has failed to address that situation adequately. So I think, I mean, that miscommunication is unfortunate between the employer and the employee, but that isn't the focus of what we as the board and we as the committee are tasked to do. We are tasked to look at our statutes and see if there is any communication that harmed the public. And in this instance, we have a very specific statute that deals with abandoning or neglecting a client or a patient. But that statute deals only with patients in need of immediate care. And I don't see anything in the records that were supplied to us from the complainant showing how that particular provision was violated. So that's sort of my assessment of this case. I would favor dismissal of the complaint, but before I say that for sure, I want to see what Dr. Gill and Dr. Catarino have to say about this. Thank you.
I agree with you regarding 16 subsection V that uses the terminology of immediate care. The reality is we don't know if they had, if they required immediate care or not. We don't know. And that I find that disturbing. I want to be sensitive because Dr. Mumby, it sounds like she's been to hell and back since she first applied for a leave of absence. And I agree with you, Mr. Dinar, that that has to be a consideration. But, you know, you can say that the parent company took her electronic access away, but she has still has the responsibility or her, someone on her behalf has the responsibility to transfer cases and to terminate cases where appropriate and to address the interruption of services and for that to be properly documented, which is missing here. So I don't agree with dismissing this case. I think the ethical issues that apply here in consideration of her illness and everything else that she reported is regarding 10.09 and 10.10, interruption of therapy and terminating therapy, I don't think was handled properly. And I think she has to take some responsibility for that. And those are my comments.
Yeah, and I agree with Dr. Gill. I think it was less than a week, but there were some days that she was still in the office when she had access to the computer, when she knew she was going to be leaving at the end of that week, that she could have made a list of all the clients and their contact information and given it to her supervisor and called or emailed as many as she could have. I think more, you know, we're looking at possibly she contacted 50%, and I think she could have at least contacted all the active clients.
Yeah. I only had a day.
You had one day?
Yeah, I only had a day. I'm so sorry to interrupt, but...
No, I appreciate you telling me that. But in that one day, you could have made a list of all the clients and given it to your supervisor and said, I can't do this. It's too much for me to do in one day.
Well, at 12:15, we did meet, HC and I, and there was an email and validation of that meeting that we did. We discussed where all the caseload was with everything. And so we did have that, essentially that transfer of temporary care. And HC never voiced any other concerns or deficiencies in that process.
So when did you contact the 20 or so people you did contact? That afternoon?
It was that day, that morning. Yeah, it was that morning. I was like hell going through and just trying to, and I did have, I did have the session with the mom and the adolescent, and I did have a follow-up one as well with someone else that I can recall. So that's what I meant when I said I did do my due diligence, despite being under a lot of physical pain, to be able to go through that and then still follow up with my supervisor, HC. I totally agree. If I had a week, it would have been completely different. How it looks like it was a week because it was a Friday of the 25th. They termed the access on the 28th, but my leave started the 25th per the HR approval.
So you contacted people in that morning, and then in that afternoon, after that meeting, there was no time to write down the name of the other active clients and give that to the supervisor?
No, that's what I did. That's what
you gave them the names.
Yeah, like we went through the whole list. We actually have a shared spreadsheet So it was very easy to refer to, and that's what we did with our supervision time as well. We would go through, and remember, this was my 90-day training, so I was learning how to document, as we didn't have that admin staff. So it was very common for us to go through each patient very quickly and expeditiously, you know, where are they at, how are they doing, next appointment, do we need to refer, bring someone else in. So that actually was done.
Was it clear to your supervisor? I mean, did you make it clear? Like, I didn't have time to contact them. Will you take over contacting them? You know, did you directly say that and she agreed?
Yes, that's what I'm saying, especially with those patients who were already, they were on their way out. There has to be so many days in between. You can't just contact someone 3 days in a row and, you know, expect them to close them out. That wouldn't be ethical. So we were talking and focusing on the 2-week time frame. And it was, I thought, a very nice coordinated effort. She was so supportive. And again, she didn't let me know that there was any deficiencies or especially as she was helping me learn this documentation system. I was inadequate. You know, I truly do feel like it wasn't a good place. And I was actually really proud of myself that I helped the two patients and meet with them and not just leave suddenly. As I really tried hard.
Well, you know, Mr. Diner, do you have anything else to add? Because I'm still mulling this over now.
I see Dr. Gill's hand up, and I know we went.
I think this has to be said, even though the parent organization is not subject to review here. Maybe as a clinician, I am stunned that they would refer someone, a trainee, upwards of 70 people, or maybe 80, whatever the number is. As a caseload, that to me is stunning in and of itself. To me, full time is less than 46, and that's the arbitrary number that we've come up with in terms of active patients. There's something haywire in that, and for that, I can appreciate Dr. Mumby's situation that there's no cap on the caseloads, but nevertheless, there is a failure of documentation. I can't get away from that. So I'm going to leave it at that.
Do you have anything else you want to say, Mr. Donner? Because I'm torn now.
So I think, as far as I'm concerned, there isn't a violation of subsection V. But I understand Dr. Gill's point that, you know, there might be something in the ethics rules, which is covered by subsection DD, that might be applicable here. Now, I don't quite want to support the idea that, you know, we as the board, I mean, right now we are the committee, but eventually if this matter gets to the board, if we as the board are, you know, sort of trying to regulate the communications between an employer and an employee, that just doesn't sit well with me. I mean, there's a lot of labor relation law that comes into play in those settings. I don't know why, for instance, the employer chose to cut access to patient records to Dr. Mumby, because if we as the board are saying that Dr. Mumby is responsible for contacting all these patients, and if she does not have access to those records, no meaningful access to those records, then I don't see how that is Dr. Mumby's fault. It could be the employer, you know, that the employer might need to iron out some of its processes, but is that really what our statutes allow us to do? I don't know. From my perspective, we are looking at Dr. Mumby's actions or inactions and seeing if there is a violation of the statute. If there's anything in the ethical standards, again, I'm, you know, Dr. Katrin or Dr. Gill, you guys are sort of the experts on that. I can read and I can, you know, maybe form an assessment as to what an ethical standard says, but that's really, I look to you for guidance on what that means in this particular scenario. I don't see a violation of subsection B, but I'm open to being convinced that there's a violation of subsection DD.
You know, because I'm really torn by this, maybe should go to the board and get another opinion. But maybe that you're right. See, I agree with Dr. Gill. We don't know the status of those clients. She reports that they're stable, but sometimes you just can't tell, you know. So we don't know if during that time they might have needed help.
Yeah. What happens in cases where people want to go back to therapy and, you know, there's nobody available based upon how a case was transitioned? I mean, that to me is a, I hate to say it because I know Dr. Mumphy was going through hell, and I don't know how to mitigate that, but I do think that documentation, transition, care matters, and she has the license. She has to take responsibility for that. This is not about saying that what the parent company did was so great either, but we're not here to evaluate them at the moment, and I think in the end, you know, she's licensed, and if she's not able to do it herself, she has to find someone who will do it, and that's on her. I'm sorry.
Yeah. If you make a compelling case, I agree with you.
And you can look at this as a referral to the board for a possible violation. We may be able to get more information once it goes to the full board. I don't think we'll ever know the question about whether there were any patients that were in immediate need, because we just don't have that, you know, retrospective crystal ball that could go back and tell us.
But I wonder, is it something?
Excuse me, Dr. Mumby.
I'm sorry, Dr. Mumby.
You can make a referral to the board for a possible violation, and obviously the board still has an option to dismiss. And sometimes nine heads are better than three.
True. I understand. I understand all of your points, and I appreciate that. I worry that this line of inquiry into, you know, how many of these 70-something patients were in need of immediate care, that is going to be information that the employer can provide us, probably. But it's going to be a lot of information, and we in hindsight will have to go through each and every case to make a determination whether that individual patient needed immediate care, and then make a determination of whether Dr. Mumby took steps to reach out to those patients to make sure that they received continuity of care.
I
just was going to conclude my thought by saying that seems to be a fishing expedition to me. I mean, I am convinced from the statements that Dr. Mumby made that she took adequate steps to make sure that in her assessment, whoever needed immediate care, she reached out to them on that day, that one day, in a few hours that she had access to all of this information. But I also understand your point that, you know, a full board might reach a different conclusion. So I'm fine with referring this to the full board, but, you know, for purposes of discussion and deliberation, I'm saying I just don't see a subsection B violation, and I'm not hearing any specific provision in the APA ethics code that is violated here. So unless you tell me otherwise, two-vote majority will be able to refer this to the board, but yeah.
We don't have any documentation about how these cases are transitioned. And I come from a point of view of if it's not written down, it didn't happen. And so documentation is critical. That's my opinion.
I agree with that.
But I'm with you on the Section 5 doesn't apply. Yeah, I agree with that.
So here's sort of my initial thoughts on that. I mean, we have sort of treated this case as a moving target. We have, at each stage, we have sort of, tried to obtain additional information from the complainants. And at what point is any information going to be sufficient to make that determination? I don't see that point coming. This is going to be a moving target, which is fine. I mean, if you want a involved investigation, so be it. I mean, that's the full board's prerogative.
If it were up to me, I'd be happy with referral to the board with the recommendation of a letter of concern and let it rest.
Yes. That's what I think so too. I wondered if it were, I know all my clients' names, even if I don't have the, records in front of me. And I wondered if you made any phone calls. I know you couldn't use the email system. Could you have called your supervisor and a week later or 2 weeks later, have you reached out to everybody? Because, I'm still very sick. I mean, did you try to phone call?
They wouldn't allow me. They wouldn't allow me. And so if you noticed, there was an email to one of the HR specialists, and I requested that be communicated, because they specifically said, for whatever reason, no client contact and no clinical contact with the supervisor about the caseload. So I think it's just because of the medical leave. I think that's why.
Okay. All right. So I agree with Dr. Gill. I've thought about it. I think it's, a letter of concern might be appropriate, but I do think we need another point of view. It's not 100% clear to me either way. And I'd like to hear the other board members' view.
Is that a motion, Dr. Gill, then?
I make the motion to refer to the board and consider a letter of concern.
I second it.
All right, there's a motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
What would be the possible violation?
I think 10.10, terminating therapy.
So 2061 DD16.
DD, yes.
DD.
Yes.
10.01.
I think Dr. Gill had referenced earlier 10.09 for interruption of therapy and then 10.10 for terminating therapy.
Yes, 10.09 as well. Yes, thank you.
I just want to clarify, there is another section of the ethics code I don't know if the committee wants to consider. It is 3.12, interruption of psychological services. It seems similar to 10.09, but I just wanted to point it out to the committee.
We can include it and then the board can review it.
Correct.
Yes.
And it might be helpful to specify, just generally speaking, what the letter of concern would address, what issues. Dr. Gill?
The issue is appropriate transition of care, appropriate how to address interruption in therapy, and how to address termination of treatment, and to document the same.
Thank you.
And Dr. Catrino, would you second all of that?
Yes.
All right, we have a motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? None opposed, the motion passes. All right, then, since that was the last complaint, the only remaining thing on the agenda is adjournment. So I move to adjourn. Do I hear a second?
Second.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. We have a motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. We are adjourned, and it is 12:59 p.m. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.